March 19, 2025 work session for the Board of Island County Commissioners, and we're going to start with our Commissioner's office. First, a reappointment to the Historic Preservation Commission, and apparently we need to do, it's going to be a one-year appointment as we had said before, and this, we really did need to kind of push this through in order for them to have quorum, I guess. So,
yes, ma'am.
And this is a reappointment.
So. Yeah, it's a reappointment for position two.
Yep.
Yep. Good. Thank you. Second is our contract with Gordon Thomas Honeywell. You bringing this to us, Susan? Is Susan here? Yeah, there she is. I don't see close with these glasses, but the distance I can't see who people are.
So the consultant you have been working with has formed their own company. And my understanding is the board is interested in working with the same consultant, with Gordon Thomas Honeywell, under his new company. So the assignment of consulting agreement is in your packet, and it effectively would move those services over to the new company under Columbia Policy Advisors.
They went with Columbia?
Columbia Policy Advisors.
It's not in them.
Now, I will pick it up with the consultant, but that seems like we're favoring a region of the state.
Okay.
You couldn't find a state-neutral name like Evergreen.
That wasn't one of the questions lovers. That I asked.
Okay, I'm going to deal with him directly.
The components of the agreement are essentially the same, with the exception of it puts a cap on expenses outside of the regular contract, like travel and such. So it's actually more favorable to the county.
Right.
Okay.
It's not cost difference, more favorable, nope. You said. So.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yep. You agree with this going to consent?
Yes.
Sounds okay. Good.
We'll put it through contractor. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you very much, Susan. You appreciate bet. That. Next item, we're not going to do the next one on the list because we don't need to. Federal Community Funding Project for 2026. Oh, I asked to bring this on. Do we have
Tristan's online, Commissioner?
Good morning, Tristan. Thank you very, very much.
Morning, of course.
For joining us. And I had asked if you would join us to talk about this a little bit when we got an email from Congressman Larson's office indicating that our transit station money had disappeared into the ether world. So can you kind of talk about where we are with that project, that funding request, any other funding requests, any suggestions that you have?
Sure. And just to be clear, you were referring to the transfer station, correct?
That's what I meant. Excuse okay. me. I didn't mean transit. I meant transfer. I appreciate that. Thank you.
No, of course. First off, appreciate the opportunity to join this morning and just give a brief recap of what's been going on in Congress over the past couple of weeks. I know we've had a chance to share some of this with Commissioner St. Clair during her visit, which we appreciated, and then preview some of it with you, Commissioner Bacon, before everything was finalized. So last week, Congress passed a continuing resolution that extends fiscal year 2024 funding levels through the duration of fiscal year 2025. So that means through September 30th. Unfortunately, that also means is that community project funding or congressionally directed spending requests were not included in the final package. There are no new starts under a continuing resolution, and these requests were explicitly left out. So this comes at an interesting time because, as staff shared with Commissioner St. Clair while she was here, with FY25 wrapped up, we expect that congressional offices are going to move immediately into the consideration of fiscal year 2026. And we also expect and have heard overwhelmingly that that is going to include the consideration once again of projects. So the approach that I think we've previewed and that we are recommending is that given the level of support that we had from Congressman Larson in the previous appropriation cycle, the fact that we were included on his list of 15 projects last year would be that we move forward with submitting the transfer station again for consideration this year. As you all will recall, the funding amount that we requested was $2.8 million. The funding level that was included in the USDA appropriations bill was $1 million. So we would recommend moving forward again with the full $2.8 million request and seeing under the appropriations environment that we're about to enter into FY26 if we can succeed in securing additional funding for the project. Understand, certainly a frustrating development. I don't think anyone that we've talked to in our visits to the Hill has been happy with this outcome. Still a lot of positivity about the opportunity to move the project forward this year. And our understanding, I think, from our conversation with various folks on the commission is that, this continues to be the priority, and it would make sense for us to continue moving forward with this project, and that it would still be timely. Through this process, our expectation would be that funding would be delivered likely Q3 of 2026. So that is the time frame we would be looking at to actually draw down the funding. But from our understanding with our conversations, it sounds like that is still an appropriate time frame for the project. So those are the high level. That's the high level of the current situation analysis. We know, like I said, that the consideration process is moving forward steadily. So we currently expect that Congressman Larson is asking for applications by April 1st. So is Senator Murray, and then Senator Cantwell is asking for applications by April 6th. So, we have a developed project. I think we're prepared to move forward with resubmitting it this year, but happy to answer any questions on that approach and share any other feedback on what's going on in DC right now.
Any questions, Jill?
No, that seems like the right approach. I'm glad we're asking for the full amount. I was afraid you're going to say ask for the one, and I'm like, well, then they're going to give us five, which I understand 500,000 is still more than zero, but I mean, we budgeted now around that million, set our enterprise fund rates accordingly, and so I'd prefer to have the government honor its word, give us what they said they're going to, but I think that your strategy's right.
So, Tristan, what about the other funding opportunities for other potential projects like build and so on? What's the status of those?
Sure, it's a mix. And I think what we're going to be closely monitoring over the next couple of weeks is now that these agencies have their funding levels set, seeing how the forecasts themselves change and the opportunities that we've been monitoring and forecasting through our kind of proactive budget analysis. Hopefully start to be rolled out. The infrastructure projects that we have worked with you on are in an interesting bucket because they are both authorized by Congress multiple years out, and they were funded by Congress in 2021 for multiple years. In some instances, the previous administration did proactively spend some of that funding in advance, but that varies program by program. So many of them will still have operating budgets for this coming year that were already appropriated by Congress well in advance. So build, I think some of the opportunities through Safe Streets are still anticipated to move forward. Interestingly enough, our team was actually up on visiting with the Department of Transportation with the Secretary's office last week, had an opportunity to talk about their outlook for some of these programs. They were pretty adamant in those discussions that many of these opportunities are moving forward, and that the review is really just that, but they are going to be complying with the statute for bipartisan infrastructure law programs. Otherwise, for many of the other programs, it's really going to be a matter of monitoring and seeing how the budget that is now carried over from FY24 is distributed amongst many of the programs that we care about.
Thank you. Any other questions, Jill?
No.
All right. Thank you very much, Tristan. I'll see you on Monday or Friday morning.
Sounds good. Appreciate your time. Thanks for the invite.
Thanks a bunch for joining us today.
Of course.
It's discouraging.
Oh, it's very discouraging. All righty. So the next topic we have on our agenda is budget and risk. To talk about, first of all, a broadband update. Is that one we were continuing? That's one we're not continuing?
That's the one we're continuing, Commissioner.
Okay. So we're going to go to the EDC?
Yes, sir.
Okay. We'll do broadband update another day, I guess. Okay. Hello, George. Good morning. Good morning, Christine.
No worries. You can have her.
No, well, maybe I should be standing up. Yeah.
George, she's got your chair.
How would you be speaking? Since
good to see you all.
All right. Yeah, talk about the SEDS report.
Susan, you can sit over here or over there.
I want to be able to see the screen.
Okay. I mean, everybody just lined up like a fire.
Oh,
what's
else? No.
All right, are we ready to go? Yep, okay. Good morning, commissioners. As you know, I'm Christina Hines. I'm the executive director with the Economic Development Center, Council. Can I say that right?
Yeah.
And I have with me our board president, George Henney, here to present to you today on our 2024 progress. So as you know, EDC works to create a thriving economic environment where we can, where businesses can grow and create jobs for local residents in a way that enhances and preserves our unique quality of life.
It doesn't do that on the recording. It just does that in the room.
Okay.
So,
thank you.
Yeah. It's stressful when it's happening to you, but you just get used to ignoring it.
Okay. So we support equitable business ownership and wealth creation. The way that we do this is by ensuring our programs are available to all in the county. We
is that too close?
Yeah, okay. thank you. We don't have our programs locked behind paywalls for a reason, and that is to be able to provide the best service to everybody who's looking to open businesses in the county to build wealth for both themselves and our community. We focus highly on collaboration and partnerships. So having a very well-connected community is a stronger community, responds to crisis better, also builds stronger businesses, being innovative and sharing data and information, best practices, just leads to better management of our businesses. We also monitor trends within economic development. So we are part of WIDA and numerous ADO groups. As the designated ADO, we meet regularly with our counterparts across the state to better understand what best practices look like in economic development as we pursue the economic vitality of our rural communities, which is exceptionally difficult. We also participate in advocacy. We again work with WIDA, that is the Washington Economic Development Association, which lobbies with the state on economic development related bills. And right now working with the state to ensure that our economic development programs stay on the budget without having significant cuts. So one of the main pieces that Economic Development Council does is providing programming for those island county businesses. So what we know about what we provide is that BRE, which is business retention and expansion, is one of the most effective ways of impacting economic development. That is investing in the businesses that are here and already open and ensuring that they stay open and that they grow. We are the designated ADO, which is the Associate Development Organization, given that status by both the county and the Department of Commerce. And that allows us to have access also to special recruiting programs and site selection opportunities that typically aren't widely available. We are also exploring managing the SEDS evaluation processes. So as you know, the SEDS is the Comprehensive Economic Development Strategy that was adopted by the county in July of 2024. And we will actually talk about that, I believe, following this presentation. So these were our strategic priorities for the five-year period of 2020 through 2025. As you can see, there was a big focus on economic recovery due to the COVID crisis, and resiliency is always a factor in supporting our local businesses. This past year in 2024, we had a very large transition with our executive director of 6 years, Sharon Sappington, departing EDC, and I was hired in August to assume the role. After serving as four years as the Small Business Development Advisor, so forming relationships with our small businesses in this community, understanding what their needs are one-on-one. Okay, so I have to kind of, these ones didn't make it into the your copy, so we're going to skip through that and I'll just talk about them in a minute. So these are our core work elements. Again, it's the existing business retention and expansion, new business creation and entrepreneurship, new business attraction, and readiness and capacity building. And I'll talk about why these are so important in a minute. But what they are, business retention and expansion, again, that's the expert advice and education, otherwise unavailable to local businesses, that keeps them open, growing, and contributing to our local jobs and our thriving community. 91% of businesses in Island County are small businesses. That when we look at the small business history and failure rates, it is pretty telling. So 50% of small businesses fail in the first 5 years. And of the remaining, another 50% fail in the next 5 years. So the 10-year survivability rate of a small business is low. The good news of that grim statistic is that we know why. So one of the reasons why is an education deficiency, a knowledge deficiency in financial literacy, essentially. So what we see a lot is businesses growing too fast, unable to manage their cash flow correctly. Individuals investing in a business idea that is not viable, individuals investing in a business that they have not planned for and don't completely understand the true costs of running that business. And by then they've invested a ton of money and don't want to give up. And the way that we impact those businesses and keep them from failing is to provide those educational services, and the financial literacy piece of what EDC does is extremely important to continuing to have our businesses succeed. We do have a one-on-one business advisor as well that EDC invests in with the Small Business Development Center through Washington State University. So he is Steve McCaslin, and he sits one-on-one with our businesses. What we know about small businesses is that even if you have the same exact business, they all have unique challenges based on their personal circumstances, the actual circumstances of what the businesses are going through, and their general overall business operational and financial knowledge. We also focus on new business creation and entrepreneurship. So we provide that support to entrepreneurs and startups. So not only is this supporting idea generation and connecting them to like-minded individuals, but it's also being able to take their ideas and show them how to do feasibility studies to ensure that their investments are secure and that their ideas are going to work. And again, EDC provides that for free to all small businesses through both advising one-on-one through myself or through our SBDC advisor, Steve McCaslin. Readiness and capacity building. So as you know, EDC was the catalyst and managed the Comprehensive Economic Development Strategy known as SEDS, which was again completed in July of 2024. This particular project not only allows us to apply for federal funding in infrastructure planning, but also produces validity across the board to state organizations as they see that the county has planned a development strategy in the economic ecosystem. We're also enhance connections and partnerships, right? So we are the organization that is connecting people. So just this last week, I had about 4 phone calls from or emails from people saying, hey, this is a project I'm working on. Do you know somebody who might be interested in investing in this project or continuing to develop it with me? And it's really fun to be able to connect people and have them say, oh my gosh, this was perfect. Thank you. We also recently had an organization funded through this type of connection. So 2 organizations, actually, and I can talk about that in a little while as well. We participate in the local leadership training, so Leadership Would Be. We currently run their Economic Vitality Day, but are also joining their overall advisory committee for the organization. And again, we're trying to collaborate with local government on projects that align with economic vitality as they become available. And of course, we keep in contact with the Department of Commerce for any grant opportunities for our small businesses or for our organization to expand our services. So for our new business attraction, which is also called recruitment, we have our data on our website. This is an important aspect of what we provide. It's an expensive portion of what we do. But this data is used by companies looking to move into our area. Businesses saying, hey, you know, I want to know what the population looks like. What do the demographics look like? How much income are we dealing with in this area? What does the workforce look like? They're using that data from our websites. The site selectors and larger businesses know to look at economic development organizations' websites for that data. It's a best practice across the board for economic development. Again, we have targeted recruitment efforts. So one of the things that we're working on doing is assessing areas of Island County, which types of businesses best fit within that area to be able to then strategically recruit them. We participate in the Hot Project List. So this is Department of Commerce sending the ADOs. Hey, these organizations are looking, this is what they're looking for: space, power, water, workforce. Do you have any locations that might be able to fulfill this? I'm currently putting together a list of developers also to better understand projects that might be in the works or at least doable in the future so that we have a better idea of how we can impact these hot lists. Okay, so I'm not sure if this slide made it into the packet, but it is actually later on anyway here. So we have 106 businesses that were impacted by EDC in 2024. This resulted in approximately $1.5 million of capital infusion, which essentially means loans or a private investment into those businesses, either keeping them open and running, which one of them was a business sale that kept the business in this county, as well as keeping the property that was owned by the business. These are important because, as you know, the biggest revenue streams, sales use tax, property tax, as well as B&O tax, are all impacted by your small businesses here in the county. We had 4,100 outreach interactions. So those are typically email blasts and or Facebook posts. We had 168 participants in 17 different community activities that we performed. 4 different site selector contacts and 390, actually that number is probably a bit low because we don't completely have all of that reporting recorded yet, but 390 approximately volunteers of our board members and expert advice and support from their knowledge base. So again, the SEDS that we helped initiate was put into place in 2024 of July. These are the goals of the SEDS, and I believe I'm going to skip over this because we'll talk about that in a minute, about how one of the pieces of the requirements of the SEDS is to have monitoring and evaluation of the ongoing performance of that, or of that particular planning. Again, we're part of Leadership Whidbey. This is, in my opinion, a critical leadership development program to assist our county in not only developing future leaders, but identifying them. It's a really effective program across the board, as we see other counties also having these same type of programs for really specific regional adaptive challenges. It's important we consider these because of our county, where we live, how far from the interstate we are, all the different challenges that we face as a county, to have a leadership program that actually incorporates those types of learning pieces into how we make change moving forward and ensure that we are serving the population.
So I've been saving my questions, but I have to step up on this one. The reason that the Board of County Commissioners has never been very involved in Leadership Whidbey, I mean, I attend things, but it's because it's Leadership Whidbey. It's not Leadership Island County, and it doesn't include Camino Island.
Mm-hmm.
And so do you know if Camino Island has access to anything similar to Leadership Whidbey?
So Snohomish has a similar program. I am not sure if they allow Camino residents. I would assume that they do. They are very tight-knit relationship, but I will definitely find that out. But there is one in Snohomish. These programs started to kind of make their way up through rural communities through Snohomish and Skagit and now Island County as well.
Yeah, actually at Helen Price Johnson's suggestion, I actually was a Leadership Snohomish County graduate a few years ago before Leadership Whidbey was started. And actually it fledged Leadership Whidbey. So I think it's a terrific question of how we can expand and incorporate that truly as Island County. Mm-hmm. It's a good question.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yep. We also still have our size up tool on our website. This allows businesses to take a look at where other businesses are located. So if they want to know how many coffee shops are in a particular area, they can pull up that information easily to determine maybe where they want to be located. As you know, space is a little bit of a limitation here in our county. So having that information is important, but it also lets them know how many employees other people have, how much general revenue they may have. Obviously, revenue numbers are really hard to pull as an accurate number, but it does use census data, and it is a free tool for right now for our businesses to use in their planning. These, again, the reports that we provide on our website. So our Island County profile is used a lot, especially by our real estate agents in determining key information about Island County, the living wage information, taxable retail sales, the major employers, the economic impacts of travel or tourism, the NASWE economic impact report for the Navy base, our demographic information, retail leakage and taxable retail sales, what the labor market looks like, our agricultural profile, and we're looking to add more information to this reporting that can be used by businesses in their planning efforts.
Do those reports use actual numbers, or do they use actual numbers plus the like inflationary factor, or that's not the right name, but it's where you like say a dollar multiplier factor?
I believe they use straight numbers. So they're using numbers a lot from the Employment Security Department. Okay. So we're pulling in the census. So it's pulling, you know, a lot of those numbers are self-reported. So there can be some data problems.
But it's not taking a dollar and then inflating it or multiplying it by like 3 or 2 and a half. Okay.
No.
Great. Thank you. I just want to make sure I understand what I look at when I look at.
So coming in 2025 is really an enhancement on our collaborations and network building. It's a gap that's been identified in just enhancing our relationships and knowing who is interested in what projects, how to get them performed is a key piece to connecting our community and ensuring projects get completed. This allows businesses and EDC to leverage resources. So we have businesses that aren't creating a wheel from scratch. They have input from other businesses. They may be able to leverage their customers, which improves their situation as well. Let's see. We also continue to work on DEI in our work and ensuring that we're providing everybody that equitable access to creating small businesses within our community.
Do you track demographic information when you're like on the statistics of who we're serving and who we're helping? Is there a demographic breakdown associated with that as well?
Yes and no. So our SBDC center does track that data. EDC in and of ourselves, we do not, but that is something that we are putting into place to track in the future so we better understand who our customers are.
Okay. Yeah. And I'm just, again, thinking about small businesses and some of the cultural differences between the types of businesses that people want to open. We had an individual work here. She opened her own business and she told me what she was opening. And I thought, well, who's going to go to that? Well, I'm not, because I'm not the target audience, right?
Right.
It wasn't for me. I don't understand the need within the community for that type of service, but there is one, right? And so it's just making sure that we're like culturally aware in this approach to give the right kind of business advice, because different people need different things because they're targeting different audiences.
Right.
One of the great things about our SBDC program is that they do have different languages that they speak. They don't use translation services. They actually have people who speak the language natively,
right,
to be able to participate with clients. So it is a really great feature of having SBDC is that anybody can be served by them in the state.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
What is your board makeup? Who's on your board?
So we have George Henney is our board president.
Mm-hmm.
Jeffrey Pleat is.
I don't need human names.
Oh,
okay. I just want to know what positions or where they come from or.
That's a great question. Do you want to answer that or do you want me to jump in?
You can go ahead.
Sure. So the way we approach the membership of our board, first off, obviously, we want to be reflective of our community itself, right? So the interesting thing about our community is we actually have 4.5, I say 4.5 anyway, different distinct areas in our county. We have North Whidbey. We have the Navy that sits inside North Whidbey that is its own little entity, and you have to consider that a little bit differently. It's a gravity well, but it doesn't necessarily reflect all of the people on North Whidbey, right? So then you've got Central Whidbey and the different kind of demographic and the different kind of economic opportunities and businesses and the like. We've got our county seat here and so forth. Mm-hmm. And then South Whidbey, we have businesses that tend to be more focused towards the mainland or take a benefit of you know, our broadband. There are a lot of telecommuters and that sort of thing. And then there's Kameno, which obviously has its pull towards Skagit County and the like as well. So we have those 4.5 different kinds of communities. So from that, we like to take a look at what are the constituents of how many board members can we have? We obviously have ex officio members. We have, our member of the Island County Commissioners on our board. We have the municipality and civic leaders. We like to pull from public entities as well as chambers of commerce and different kinds of things. But then you got to say, well, we have to reflect the character and the values of these different areas on our board. And so you have to be reflective of how do you find the businesses that are motivated by doing the right thing for small businesses on North Whidbey, in Central Whidbey, and South Whidbey, and Kameno. And so we've recruited people like Brandon Erickson, who's a real champion over there on Kameno. And, on South Whidbey, we you know, obviously I'm there, but we have other people that are there. And then North would be, and financial folks like Jeff Pleat, people who have been, you know, we try to pick off different kinds of folks. This is not the kind of board that you sit on and, you know, put on your laurels. This is an active working board. We want people who are engaged and really want to help this community thrive. And so ultimately, as we sort of filter these different overlapping objectives that we have, we can't solve every one of them. We've got a certain segment that we have to pull from and then limit from publics, and then how many do we pull from small business, and do they have the time?
Do they, I'm sorry, do people go on by their position in terms of association with an organization, or does the seat belong to the person?
I'm so glad you asked that, and because
so are we actually.
There are some positions that are granted by fiat. So like, for example, the county Island County Commissioners has one member that is whatever member you choose is on that. We're actually trying to get clarity ourselves, because we've had some people that we recruited as a member of an organization, and then they're no longer a member of an organization. We had somebody who went to the city of Oak Harbor from being, you know, the Chamber of Commerce leader up in Oak Harbor, for example. We had Jack Eng that was, you know, crossing the two areas of both being a small business and being a port commissioner, right? So we're trying to figure that out. And actually, we would love to get some more input on how best to do this, because at some point you have to say, it could be a position, it could be an organization, but we actually need to get clarity on that ourselves, because we've had some awkward situations where, honestly, we didn't have a good answer. The bylaws are a little fuzzy in that respect. And so we need to say it's either a position of a company, so the CEO or a member of a bank, for example, or it can be a member of an organization like a city or municipality. The mayors, for example, are a perfect example. But then what do you do about small businesses? What do you do about port commissioners? What do you do about people that change in and out of responsibilities? It's a perfect question, and it's exactly the right timing to ask that.
So about how many people serve on this board?
We have,
I think, 17.
I was going to say 17 right now. We have a capacity of, I think, up to 20 something, but then at some point it becomes a little unwieldy. And
17.
We have a hard time with three.
Well, you see the challenge here. So we're both trying to be reflective of the DEI. I mean, obviously that's a term that people are using these days. But basically, we're taking a look at who's reflective of our county. And there, you know, we do have to be considering, you know, the elements of, you know, how many male figures do we have? How many female figures do we have on the board? We have to think about some of these nuances. You know, I on the executive committee want to have a representation from all of these different quarters and not overwhelm it one way or the other. So your input would be really valuable right now, actually, as to sort of, you know, not that it drives the bus, but it says, here's what we think would be helpful for you folks to feel like we're representing the county. And that's really our objective. Is that all right?
Did I say
that okay?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, we do drive the bus a little more than you think, because it's our money.
And
so I'm not trying to be rude.
Not at all.
But I mean, we don't have to give you any money.
That's true.
We do. So we would like to be a part of the bus a little
Indeed.
More than an ex officio voice, I think, given the fact that it is on county life support most of the time.
So
I think we'd be interested in being part of the bylaws conversation. I think
sure.
we would like to see a little more clarity of, you know, I don't have any specificity, but if it's five business people and four chamber, something
sure.
more.
Clean. Well, we would like that too. There have been challenges in the past with or people representing organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And personality challenges and things like that. What do you do? That's a great question. So when you actually look at the bigger picture, let's take a look at this right now in our real-time context. The biggest challenge that we have all together is about those sudden shockwaves of funding The county is feeling that are generated from federal decisions, sometimes state decisions, and they roll down to us. And I don't mean just the counties. I'm talking about us too, and the small businesses, the people who are, you know, looking to be supported and helped. So when we take a look at how we actually are doing our funding historically, you know, we have the requirements of the Department of Commerce. So we have some strictures on that, and we get some funding from that. Mm-hmm. We have, of course, Island County and your requirements and your goals and objectives, as well as then we have our own set of objectives that we would like to do too. Now, here's the interesting thing. When you're presented with financial challenges, you can do a couple of things. One is you can turtle. You can go, the sky is falling. Or you can say, the sky is falling. But what this is really teaching us is we need to look for new and better ways of engaging our community in helping to find alternative revenue streams that we haven't really done as much in the last few years as we used to. And how do we engage better with businesses? How do we help ultimately drive and lighten the load so that you don't feel like you are the dependent factor in it? Now, it's a balance, a partnership between the EDC and the county. We're solving and helping your objectives, and you're helping us in the process, and we're fulfilling objectives for you. Now, one of the things, I'm going to digress for just a second. The reason why I am so excited to have Christina on board, if it isn't really obvious, is because she possesses some interesting and as far as I was concerned, unique characteristics that help us in this moment in time, in all these respects. In the first place, as a former SBDC advisor, she was not only engaged with the small business, she was helpful. She has a financial background. She understands how to get people to balance their budgets. She understands marketing. She understands how to inspire. She is out there and engaged in a more active and vital way. And you know what? That kind of advocacy and that kind of awareness ultimately generates excitement. And that says, instead of people saying, I don't know who the EDC is or what they do, it's about, wow, I could benefit from that. And even if it's $5 or $10 a month, if you can make somebody's business better for 2 cups of coffee a month, materially, and improve their bottom line, it helps the county's bottom line. It helps all of us thrive. The reason why those data are important in those sub areas and things like that is because you want to be around a vital area. Think people that are doing good coffee shops do with a retail shop that complements it, right? That's the way Langley and Freeland and Coopville and Oak Harbor wants to be even more. That's wonderful. So the kinds of things that we do as an EDC are not the way that they have been historically, and that's good. We're excited about where we go because we need to change the way that we think. We need to think about what those small businesses need. 91% of the businesses in Island County, small businesses, we got to make sure that we're paying attention to the 91% and not just simply focusing on the 9%, because too often people get locked into the idea of what that 9% is all about, and that's all they focus on, and leave the businesses that really need the help in the dust. And so what makes me really proud of where we're heading now is that Christine is doing things differently than we ever have been in engaging and inspiring people to, just like she said, it's a different ball game. And I'm really excited about where we're going from here. And that's going to help answer your questions. It also is an opportunity for us to do more to reflect the nature and character of our community on our board, because those board members ultimately are the ones who I take a look at and we take a look at as far as leadership, and we want them to be engaged. We don't want them to be sitting on their backsides and just, you know, participating with name only. That's not good for anybody. So we need your input, your thoughts, your suggestions. It's dynamic. It's a two-way street, and it makes me very excited about where we're heading from here. I'm happy to have been the president. I'm actually terming out at the end of June, so unfortunately, I will not be in this seat exactly. I'll still be on the board and probably the executive committee. But that's the kind of thing that I think you guys have really been such a wonderful part of, especially through this COVID crisis that we've all encountered. Thank you for that. You guys are incredible. I'm really, really grateful to you, all of you, for everything that you have done for the EDC over these years too. Thank you, Jill. Thank you, Melanie. And thank you, Janet.
Thank you. We need to get moving a little bit.
Oh, excuse me.
It's okay. We need to get moving because we have to be done by noon. What time is it you need to leave, Commissioner?
It could be a little afternoon.
But so I was wondering, Christina, did you have anything more that you wanted to share with us, particularly with regard to the SEDS report that we need to...
Sorry,
sorry. It's completely fine. I think, Cody, are you going to get us through that?
Yeah, so we wanted Cody Bakken, ARPA broadband coordinator. I've recently taken on the responsibility for the
program. Yeah, Cody, we are changing your title.
Your title does not cover
catch all for all high priority projects.
The problem with being a generalist, sorry.
Thank you.
We have been, Christina and I have been talking about the reporting aspect of the SEDS requirements, and we are developing a scope of work that would be pretty agreeable and meets all the requirements under the law. The discussion came from the fact that the contractor that did the SEDS report, the SEDS last year, had some disagreements on how to make that happen. So we're looking to add this scope of work as an amendment to the contract. And then we would have to talk about what that kind of thing would cost. Great thing is, I think it's still going to be a pretty affordable thing for us to do.
Great. So when will you be bringing that to us, Cody, do you think?
I think we'll probably have it in the next couple of weeks, mm-hmm. probably.
Yeah.
Okay. Should be pretty easy to finish up.
Okay.
All right.
Did you have any more questions?
No, I'm glad we're finding a solution for the SEDS monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think, again, the original contractor did an excellent job. And I think our requirement for their insurance is probably a little bit misplaced for the work that they would be doing for us. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why we would need liability insurance for somebody to just simply update a plan. That feels a little like the risk pool needs to understand the differences of paving a road versus, you know, contracting work. But I appreciate that you're willing to take this on and that we understand we're negotiating for a rate for that. I think also on the SEDS, you know, we did that in conjunction largely with the city of Oak Harbor. They pushed that issue because that's what they wanted to have be the economic development document that they wanted to use. I bring that up because it's important that people don't just go off, municipalities don't just go off and do their own economic development plan that's not coordinated with that SEDS, or that SEDS isn't going to work. So it's got to fold into that and be done in conjunction with it. And if we need to change goals in it, I mean, I think that will be probably the early challenge in monitoring, is just to make sure that we get used to the culture of having a SEDS,
mm-hmm.
and not standalone plans.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't had it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just new. Like we're really culturally used to do a plan, get excited, put it on the shelf, do a new plan. And so this idea that the new information updates this plan and we stay coordinated and we stay in conjunction with, I wanted to kind of put out there that I think that will be probably the greatest challenge, is just that cultural change of thought process, right? That you've got to feed your plan into the SEDS, and the SEDS is like a countywide comprehensive plan for economic development. That's also why I'm thankful that you're willing to consider taking this on, because I think as people recognize that the EDC is where the comprehensive plan for economic development rests,
mm-hmm.
I think that feeds into what you're talking about more, and it's that understanding of partnership and coordination. And that document hasn't existed in a way that allows that strategy to be apparent.
Right.
So I think it's a good fit. I just wanted to kind of give a fair warning / we're here for support, because I do think there'll be some cultural tensions in just getting people to update this particular plan.
Sure.
But speaking to that, I wanted to say something. I said when at the Rotary, I actually see Christina all over the community. Every time I go someplace, oh, there's Christina.
She's great.
She is. She's very good at that, what you said, George. It's been interesting to me in the last couple of months seeing a number of reports coming from the state that actually referred to Island County SEDS. So for example, one example is the recent ferry report that mm-hmm. refers to Island County SEDS as one of its sources. And so that reiterates the need of what you were just saying. This is an important document. It's not just our document. This is a document other people are looking at, that other people pull from and that they review. So we do have to make sure that we are keeping it updated.
I think that's terrifically said. And one of the things that it inspires me to say is, if we can be the example for others to follow, that's a really great place to be, because, you know, it says that we're the ones holding the light up, right, for others to follow. And that's a really neat thing. Whether it doesn't matter what side of the Nile you are on, it's the fact that people are willing to follow something that is inspiring to them and that they can follow and not have to do all the hard work, especially if we've already done it or in the process of doing it. And one of the fun things I think about the SEDS is that it opens up grant opportunities that we just didn't have before that required a SEDS. So we're excited about figuring out how we can take advantage of those things. I mean, granted all the chaos that's going on with financing and all the different ways, but I think there's still opportunities out there, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely.
Speaking about that, God, I wasn't going to say anything. Should I say it?
Are you asking me?
You, thank you. So if you're going to be looking for federal funds, you may want to change their language that you use when you talk about our desire to be, involve everyone in the community, because you specifically referred to, you had some hot button kinds of words that the feds will just see those hot button words and then you will not get the money.
Right.
So,
it is something that we're going to take a look at. And, you saw that our strategic plan was initially from 2020 to 2025. I remember drafting that. Boy, we had a lot of great ideas and so forth. And then COVID hit. And then, well, now we've weathered through that. But as we revise that and update that and clarify where we're heading now, I think that it's a great time to just, tighten up and maybe just nuance the language a little bit so that everybody can feel comfortable with what we're doing.
I think the language that the federal government has a lot of concerns with is the DEI language.
Right.
And really, I mean, I understand, I'm around people frequently who get triggered by the expression.
Right.
And I'm like, but it means including all elements of your economy in your plan. It means including all citizens in your plan. It means developing economic opportunities in all areas of your community at different income levels, for different language groups, for different cultural groups.
Yes.
I mean, and so I think it's just, we talked about this yesterday. I was like, say it. Melanie's like, be smarter about it. Fine. But I think the point is that you can talk about the context of what you're trying to do without using the expression that just pushes people.
Right.
Apparently too far, because they've decided it means something that it really doesn't. We're just trying to make sure, like you are, that there's not a segment of the population that does not have access to economic opportunity. That's all we're trying to do.
Exactly.
And who wouldn't want that? Like, I need everybody to be richer than me, because I get paid by taxes, so go people.
Right. It's well said. That's really well said.
See,
thank you. Very well. Yeah, very well,
well
done.
Said. Well, I just say the thing. Melanie's like trying to climb towards the outcome. I'm like, here, don't do that.
Well, great. I interrupted your presentation. Was there anything else on your presentation you thought was really important for the commissioners to know right now?
Just how important our programs are as we look at the state budget. Commerce programs are up there to be cut, and it's detrimental to our business community to not have the support. I told a story to our membership quite recently of why I do this work, which I will probably talk about a little bit next week. But watching businesses fail is not easy. It's lost investment. It's the lost tax dollars, lost dreams. It's a lot of loss when a business doesn't work out. And our programs help defend against that, so people don't become just one of those statistics of failure.
Right.
And it's super important to continue to support those businesses, so we do have a tax base to provide services to the community.
Right. And a friend who is a publisher of a newspaper, and when there was the economic downturn, she taught me this thing, which applies to economic development as well. She was like, the best time, because people cut their marketing budgets first in bad economies, right? And she's like, the best time to spend on marketing is in a bad economy, because when you come out of it, you're well positioned and ready to go. And all the people who didn't advertise aren't branded, aren't. And so it is an opposite way of thinking, but it's true about economic development and emphasis in a bad economy pays off dividends in the long run versus retracting during that time period.
Right.
You got to kind of lean in and know you're going to come out the other side.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I will try to keep that lesson in mind as we prepare for what's ahead.
And cool. we appreciate your support and your guidance, and looking forward to continuing our relationship and hopefully expanding it.
Yep.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you again.
Yeah, go ahead.
Before we move on to the next topic and let you go, there is one more thing that we need to kind of clear up just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
In the contract with the EDC, it does say under Section 2 reporting that EDC should be doing reporting on a quarterly basis.
Right.
Christine and I were discussing that, and we felt that it might be more advantageous on both sides if the reporting was semi-annual, if that is acceptable to the board. Two reports a year versus four reports.
I wasn't on the Board of County Commissioners when the decision was made to have set that expectation that the EDC report on a quarterly basis. I think that was because there was a sense at that time that the EDC was just off doing whatever. But do you have any thoughts about that, Commissioner?
I think twice a year is fine. It is a accountability mechanism that was put in place when, I'll be blunt. There was a time period where we pulled our head up and all of a sudden the EDC was focused on tourism, and we have a board that's focused on tourism. And we're like, that's not the function we're paying for. We're actually paying for that considerably with another organization, with another funding source. And so at that point, there was kind of a greater need to monitor activities.
Mm-hmm.
And then also I think Commissioner Sinclair had a concern about how much Camino Island outreach was happening.
Right.
But I don't think the report necessarily is what gives us that. It's that touchstone piece of communication. So I don't have a concern about the twice annually. I think it's once annually tends to be a little bit long. And if we're starting to go in different directions, like if the board thinks we're doing one thing and the EDC board thinks we're doing another thing, that becomes problematic for everybody because then we have public moments. So I don't have, quarterly is pretty intense in terms of the amount of time it takes to prepare even and get in front of us. I don't think that's really realistic. So
that was exactly
if you're
logic.
Okay with it, then
okay,
I'm okay with
great.
It.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So we're all on the same page about that. And I'm really happy that the contract allows us that flexibility. So we'll be bringing the scope of work for the SEDS reporting as an amendment to the contract in a few weeks. Once everything has been hammered out, we will come to work session to discuss what the real numbers for that will be. And we'll adjust the schedule that is included in the scope of work for reporting as appropriate.
Okay, terrific.
So
you're welcome.
You.
Our pleasure.
Appreciate it very much.
Right.
It was good.
Yeah.
Thanks again.
So Susan, you have the Rural County Economic Development Program now.
Have that.
Thanks for coming out.
You're much welcome. It's lovely to see you.
Mm-hmm.
So for the time being, the Rural Economic Development Program is for managing is under the Budget and Risk Department. Mm-hmm. I don't know what will happen with the Chief of Staff, but for now, there's some action items that need to come forward. The first part of this, I'm going to turn over to Cody, and then I'll talk about the financial portion of it, mm-hmm. and then we'll ask for direction from the board.
So back to me. So we have the policies as outlined for the Rural Economic Development Infrastructure Investment Program as decided by the board in 2024 and solidified. And so I went through and I didn't make any substantive changes. That was not my intent nor my position. There were like extra periods and stuff, but I did go through the policy pretty thoroughly, and I am prepared to post it up on the website so that it's available for those who need it. There's the application, which I will be including a guideline for what is going on in the application. Mm-hmm. And we changed the order of a couple of the questions just to make it flow more logically, which should be an easier way to just fill out the application.
Can we, did we adopt the policy? We talked about the policy, didn't we?
I think we did.
Did we take action to adopt it? I just don't remember.
I believe that we did adopt the revised policy. Okay.
I believe I saw at least work session documents. I'll verify that there was the
adoption.
Yeah.
Adoption. I know we talked about it. And then I know we have criteria. Do we have anything that says that you can only have so many open applications at the same time, or you can only have so many projects going at the same time before you reapply for another grant? Do we have anything like that in there
from the applicant perspective?
Right. So if you're working on three rural county economic development grants right now, that you're not applying for a new one, do we have any limits on how many active grants an entity can have at the same time? I don't think we do, but maybe we do.
I didn't. But from a project management perspective, there is a realistic limitation to how much your organization can handle.
Right. And I think you're looking at it the way I'm looking at it, which is you're not going to be able to get all these things across the finish line. But I'm also looking at it for what people want to do, which is secure the money and then hold it until they get to the projects. And I think we need something in there that says you just can't have that many active projects going at the same time. I mean, mm-hmm. we obviously have the ability to say no, but this isn't designed to just reserve money for mm-hmm. when you get to it. It's really designed to utilize that money in a timely way and get your projects out the door. And so I think how many open grants you can have is something we should consider. And if it's not in there and we've already adopted, I'd leave it out. If it hasn't been adopted, I might consider that are putting something in there that just says, like, you've got to get your grants completed before you start asking for new grants somehow.
Well, they can.
Huh?
Currently they can ask, but then you come full circle back to, you already have these and we can't consider this.
Right. It's just easier for us to put nip the politics in the bud before they start.
Oh, it's because, a policy.
You know, or if you've turned back money, then, you know, if you took money and you've turned it back, that maybe you sit out a grant cycle so that we build in some consequences to not following through on what you took and dedicated for yourself. I think to get some real realism around these requests and not just hopes. I mean, like, I don't mean to pick on Oak Harbor, but they took a bunch of money for the marina project and then they didn't do the marina project. And we set that money aside, not the $1 million, but they had that business development one. Mm-hmm. And that money got held for like 3 or 4 years before they turned it back and said they're not going to do the project. The Port of South Whidbey has done similar things. I think there needs to be some kind of built-in consequence for that a little bit, which is you have to set out a cycle. If you reserve money and you don't use it, that's just a thought.
There are some there's some language about limitations on completion of the project, requirement to check in at a certain point if you do need a deadline extension.
Mm-hmm.
But it really does leave the board with the reins ultimately on approving all of those timelines. I did find a document in the in our shared drive that is the resolution for adoption.
Okay.
I don't see a signed version, but I'll check with the clerks about that. So with that, I think we're ready to move on to the balance portion.
Well, so maybe I missed this. When does the period for application?
We're going to go over the balance and the status of it first, and okay. then we'll get to the questions we need to ask you.
Okay. Which revolves around the schedule, which we are actually behind in the schedule right now, okay. as per the policy. Sure. So that's part of the discussion.
Okay.
The big
picture in the financial of the Rural Economic Development Fund is that there is right now about $6 million that could be awarded. So there's $9 million in the fund, but there are $3,175,000 in commitments, open commitments. That's on the schedule that was provided in the packet. It shows the awards back to 2018, ones that have been closed, completed, withdrawn, and which ones are still open.
So we have $6 million uncommitted.
$6 million uncommitted.
And to be clear, we have five commitments under the RCED program, one being the Economic Development Council, and then four projects.
The fund brings in about $1.8 million a year. Okay. Just under this last year. In 2024, it was almost $1.8 million.
I think, okay, well, never, I can, I'll wait. What's your next thing? My opinion is we need to push our internal departments to request.
I mean, I just wrote down George, but we've got a George Hernandez, but we've got a, workforce housing project in Oak Harbor that will have a tremendous amount of infrastructure associated with it because it's in the city. So it's going to need sidewalks. It's going to need pipes. It actually needs a road that cuts through the development. It's going to need all of those types of things. And this money can be used for infrastructure related to the costs associated with those affordable housing projects. Mm-hmm. That is an appropriate use. We've got Hornet Bay Boat Dock, which is an economic stimulator, which comes from Public Works. That is an appropriate use. We are not asking for this money for economic development in terms of the county uses of things.
Even my big boat launch I want to do on South Whidbey, that's an economic.
No, nobody's asking for that. Nobody is, you know, I mean, so I think that's some of what we're asking for is if you look in here, there's not allocations to Island County.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I also think, again, that I don't like sitting on this much money. I also think if we're saving it up for something, that would be great, but we don't, you know, we don't have a big infrastructure plan. And even $6 million, which sounds like a lot, is nothing when you start talking about a Freeland sewer.
We could use also that
doesn't
in a
have
second.
A discharge point.
That's right.
So I want to make sure that we're.
Commissioner, I'm ready for half of that. $6 million uncommitted to go to county projects or more.
Personally. We have to apply and we're not, you know, so maybe we can bring that up at a round table or mm-hmm. something to tell people like, look, these grants also are for us. We don't always have to look to the state. These are funding. This is a funding source that came from the state to local government to reinvest in economic development.
We can approach those departments. Though.
Okay.
Could apply for those directly.
I think that those infrastructure costs they're high for us.
We have other things that we need to pay for that we have to find the funds for, like a new electric system for this building that are going to cost a fortune that we couldn't use RCED funds, but maybe if we could use other funds for this and use RCED for it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. So you'd want to release like 3 million of it
Well, that's another part of the conversation, but I think whatever we decide to release, we should plan on really trying to do at least half of that for the county.
I mean, the county needs to apply for what it needs, right. Not more than it needs, but what it needs.
Exactly. Well, yeah.
So to summarize, the board is interested in opening the application. Does that mean that I have your permission to contact the different entities available to start the application process?
So why don't you list for the record who those entities are?
Nominally, we've had the ports, Port of South Whidbey and Port of Coopville, City of Langley, City of Oak Harbor. You were talking about the county departments also applying.
Mm-hmm. And the town of Coopville.
And the town of Coopville. There is some clarity that I wanted to ask for, and this might require an amendment to the policy. The law states under RCW 82.14.370 that government agencies and port districts, it does define special purpose districts as part of that, but that is not stipulated in our policy.
So you're saying like school boards or a rec, parks and recs district?
Mm-hmm. Or a transit agency, it if they have taxing authority, my understanding is that they qualify. And please tell me if you disagree and don't want that to happen.
I guess if the state allows that and they can show the economic attachment to their request,
right? They do have to.
We should be open to their application.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I mean, I'm for whatever it takes to get the infrastructure in place and the jobs created, mm-hmm. right? So, yeah.
Okay. So I'll do a little bit of research on that, and I can put together a full list of entities that would qualify under that determination.
Okay. Thank you.
So what I'm hearing is that you are interested in having $3 million potentially dedicated to county type projects, but how much total would you want to open up the application process for?
I mean, I was kind of opening it for up to three.
So you want to hold on to the other three in the bucket?
Well, my reasoning for thinking is that in an economic downturn, our partners are going to be looking for greater partnership. Also, we need as much money as we can have in investments. So I don't want to empty everything out right when we're going into a time period where we're going to need investment interest to make up for things like sales tax revenue that might drop. So I just didn't want to liquidate everything. I mean, not, by the way, we could say no, we could get applications and say no to everything if we mm-hmm. don't like it.
Right.
But I think probably leaving a little bit in the bank just so we have some reserve because we don't know what's coming. I mean, we might have to, you know, try to keep our tipping fees as low as possible. And there may be an economic development argument for why you need to put $1 million towards a transfer station because our federal partners have all of a sudden bailed. So I'm saying that in the sense that I don't know what's coming, and I want to make sure that we don't leave our partners out there with big funding gaps for projects we need to get across the finish line. And so I feel like we need a little bit of reserve for that.
But we'll be getting in, or we should be expecting to get in 2026, another $1.8 million. Yes. So we would have, if we did three this year, we'd still have 4.8 next year.
And we could just do a call for projects and see what comes in and always say yes or no, or not fund the full amounts, or and not put a, just do a call. If we got $10 million in applications, we can't say yes to that.
Right.
We don't have that much money. Right. So we could just do a call for projects and see what happens.
I'm good with that. And I wouldn't restrict to, well, set asides for the county. I wouldn't set it that way. I just want to be really clear that our expectation is going to be that county departments are going to apply for these funds. We're going to be really open to using them for county purposes this time, which we have not done in the past.
And then when you're talking to our partners, I would share some of the board's thoughts so that they don't put a bunch of work in our application that we ultimately say,
right,
no to. So it's like, if you've got a lot of open applications that aren't completed, if you turn back money, you should not expect to be first in line. And on open applications, I mean, I, you know, and again, I don't want to pick on anybody, but like Port of South Whidbey has a lot to pull across the finish line. I'm not particularly open to new projects from them right now. And I'm not saying that to target them. I'm saying that is an example of where you've got to get some stuff done. City of Oak Harbor has that marina money. It walked away from its acquisition money. that's another one where I'm like, you've got to demonstrate an ability to get some of these projects done before we allocate more money to you. So, and I'm not trying to say that in a threatening way. I'm trying to say that in a, from where I'm sitting, don't spend a bunch of time on an application if you haven't been able to demonstrate the ability to get some things done.
Which is a great lead into my next question for the board. What is the application window that you would like for it to be open and the full cycle? When do you want the applications to be completed? When do you want to be awarding?
What is our policy say? You said we're behind.
The policy initially started with February 15th. I updated it to say March 15th provisionally, and then we had some internal delays getting here to the work session. So we're already past that deadline.
We could use this timeline as a framework, starting from today.
Yeah.
And then try to work through it that way.
How long do we usually keep? What's our usual window?
It looks like
May, June is what it says towards the end. And then within 60 days of presentations would be the consideration and full award presentation.
So we historically, are you saying that we open it in February and then it stays open through May or June? Is that what you just said?
Well, the application would have been open for about a month. And then they would have that time after the applications are in to put together their full presentations.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So they can apply without having the whole
package. Yeah, the application is the getting the foot in the door.
Okay.
And then they have time to come back and put together everything and get all of those details that you were asking for, sure. Commissioner.
Sure.
It looks like a month is what it's open for.
Okay.
Because the county evaluates that right after that month's over.
If we did app presentations and decisions into June, first part of July, that should let everybody hit their budget cycle for final adoption if they need those budget numbers. And we still have time to adjust our budget for any allocations we made.
Correct.
I mean, I would shoot for like presentations like the end of June, decision made by mid-July or something, if we can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Mid-June to end of June decision. I mean, we usually know pretty quickly whether or not we like it. We're not an indecisive bunch. Well, unless we are.
Much.
So what is the...
So applications through the end of April. That gives you a little time.
Through the end of April?
Yeah.
So what date would you like me to open the applications?
What's reasonable for you? Because you said you need to reach out to all the...
I can reach out to the other partners,
taxing agencies
this week.
Okay.
I mean, if we're done by the end of March and the applications are in by the end of April, and then they have until the end of June to get their presentation in front of us, I feel like we're hitting it pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You think?
It's a generous timeline.
It is.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so too.
Okay.
I know that one of the things I was wanting to keep aware of is our budget cycle, and I didn't want to overload the board with budget stuff as well as all of these presentations.
So, Megan, what do we have on roundtable for this month?
This is the grants that you talked about. Okay. I just wrote that down. I don't have
anything. Oh, anything else? Okay. So could we plan to do a presentation at roundtable this month on this and the expectation the commissioners have that there will be county applications?
That's next week.
Our budget gets intense for our decision making around late August, September, first part of October is when we're at decision making overload typically. So earlier, Susan's at gathering information overload. Department heads are at information preparing overload. We're still calm.
Which is good.
Him to understand the cycle. Everybody stresses.
We take turns. We stress.
While everybody stresses, watching us stress. See, but we don't start as early as everybody else does.
Oh, I remember what summer 2024 was like in the budget office.
Yeah.
Well, so, we had other things going on.
so I want to be aware of everything and take all considerations into into it. So I will put together a presentation for Roundtable next week, and I will notify our potential applicants this week. And for a solid date, is the 24th of March acceptable?
Sure.
Okay. I'd like to give them at least a couple of days to consider if that this is even anything they want to look into. Okay. So we'll open on the 24th. That's a Monday. And completion of our applications need to be submitted by April 30th, which is a Wednesday. And then we'll move on the schedule from there for review, and then qualifying applicants to make oral presentations.
Mm-hmm. Coopville needs to get something in. They haven't asked for a while.
Yeah.
When you're talking to them.
Okay.
Just remind them that they've been out of the cycle for a while here. The port's been active, but the town hasn't been.
I will communicate that with them. That is all the questions I have regarding the RCED program for the commissioners. Susan, did you have anything else?
I have nothing further. Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Cody.
Thank you, commissioners.
All right. Well, we're going to move to planning community development, talk about community-based organizations recommendations.
Look nice. Thank you.
Good morning.
You all look good morning.
But you look morning.
Good morning, commissioners. Emily Carr on Range Planning. Like Commissioner Bacon said, we will be discussing our community-based organizations and the recommendations that they provided to the Planning Commission in early March. Mm-hmm. As a part of the Climate Commitment Act funding, Commerce awarded grants to community-based organizations, or CBOs, to support participation in our comprehensive plan update.
Do we have this someplace in our record? In our-
it is in the packet. I think it's after
their presentations. Okay, thank you.
And for everybody online, we did include the CBO presentations that were given to the Planning Commission in our packet for today's meeting. The four grant recipients for Island County include the American Legion of Camino, and then there was a consortium between three groups that was spearheaded by Goosefoot. One of them was the Agricultural Resource Committee of Island County, or ARCIC, Island Roots Housing, and then with the Environmental Action Network, or WEAN. The CBOs have been conducting outreach for the last 6 months to gather feedback on comp plan issues specific to their topic, but also of other broader interests of the community. And like I said, they presented to the Planning Commission in March this year. Before we start, each CBO submitted materials to planning prior to presenting at the Planning Commission, so we do have more in-depth materials than you might have seen in the presentations. The recommendations on the next few slides are very high-level summaries, and long-range planning will be exploring all of their recommendations presented and given to us, and will include those that fit within the county's vision for our comprehensive plan update. We are going to start with the American Legion of Camino, and any underlined recommendations were supported by the Planning Commission. There are 9 commissioners, so it is hard sometimes to get a consensus between all of them, but I do have their thoughts and questions as we go through, so I'll be fitting those in with all of their recommendations. The first one was to balance affordable housing incentives with restraint on property tax increases. The Planning Commission wanted to make a point that the comprehensive plan does not control taxes. And this is a concern that we did hear on Camino multiple times.
What do they think the nexus between the two is?
As we provide affordable housing incentives with county dollars. They think that their property taxes would increase in order to be able to provide those incentives.
I see. I don't think we have a program in the county that uses property tax dollars for affordable housing. There's a sales tax, there's dedicated real estate excise tax, there's programs specific from the state. None of them are property tax programs. So that's why I was asking, is I think that's just misinformation, that there's not, unless they're worried about a tax shift, but even still the property that the county owns is given, deeded over to a private developer for the purposes of affordable housing. And once it becomes the private developers, they're paying property tax. So I think that's why I was asking, is I'm like, what is it that they're worried about? But I don't think we could just give feedback back in the loop that that's actually not a real thing for property tax.
Exactly. I think there's a misunderstanding. And I will say before I started working here, I don't think I had all of the recognition of it doesn't all go into one pool, all of the tax dollars and grant funding. So I think the general community doesn't understand how these incentives are provided. So
there's not a specific program that they're talking about. You think it's just what we just talked about, which is a general perception.
Correct.
Okay.
And we could include something in the housing element that might just outline exactly where the dollars could come from for affordable housing incentives. The other thing that we heard from the American Legion is that they would like us to analyze the differences between affordable housing needs between our two islands. And that is something long-range planning will be doing as we consider zoning updates. As I'll use Freeland as the example, Freeland might need different updates than our Lamberts, and the Oak Harbor UGA might need different updates than other parts of the county. Next was to increase importance and highlight lack of adequate coverage of cell phone and internet service in the utilities element. I've been working with Cody to discuss a lot of that, and he's been a great help. Next is to create a trail around the perimeter of Camino Island. I will invite anybody online that's in the public to complete the park survey that will be sent out soon to everybody's mailbox. Next is to revise the economic development policy discussing retirement facilities to specify working with private and community-based nonprofit organizations. We will be adopting the SEDS report, all of their goals and policies as our economic development element. So we can always add anything in there if it fits within our values for the comprehensive plan.
Do you have any idea on the trail, if that's a separated trail or wide shoulders that allow multimodal? Are they looking for, do you know what they're looking for? Were they clear, or they just wanted to be able to move around the island more safely walking and biking?
I think it's the second part, be able to move around the island. The shoulders aren't that wide in certain areas. And then finally, the support the creation and sustainability of physical and mental health care facilities and policies. And then lastly, not on this slide, but the Planning Commission recognizes that we need to engage the community on Camino a bit more. They were just a little concerned that the other three groups that got funding were all WIPI based, and having this one group on Camino be the spearhead for the CBOs, they just saw that there was a little discrepancy on maybe, or not unbalance between the amount of WIPI comments we got versus the Camino comments.
You know, it kind of follows the population.
I want to, though, extend my gratitude to the American Legion of Camino for, you know, doing this, for gathering all of the community together, for having the meetings, for taking the ownership of this for Camino Island.
Dan was great. I helped present at two of his meetings, and they drew a good crowd, so it was good to get together with people over there and hear their thoughts. Next is the ARCIC, Agricultural Resource Committee of Island County. Their first recommendation was to define agriculture in the comprehensive plan, as is currently not defined.
The word agriculture is not defined in commerce?
It might be defined in with the state, with Commerce, the State Department of Commerce, but they asked for the definition to be included in our list of definitions.
Well, that's easy enough,
I think. The next one was to create a county agricultural advisory committee and or hire an agricultural ombudsperson position. And the Planning Commission supported having the volunteer-based advisory committee.
Do you want to hear thoughts as we go?
Yep.
Or thoughts, do you want to just have us listen?
You can do thoughts as we go.
I mean, I've heard this. My kind of general instinct is to review our existing committee structures and make sure we have a cultural voice on our existing committee structures rather than to establish a standalone committee. And my primary reason is I want the agricultural voice, but I don't think it does any good to isolate it. That I think, like on the Marine Resources Committee, there needs to be agricultural people with agricultural knowledge saying this is the ramification of these recommendations. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, even on the Planning Commission, that somebody who understands agricultural should be involved in the Planning Commission conversations, and we should really make an effort to try to find that voice in our community health advisory plan, right? That we're talking about the importance of access to natural food, food deserts, all of those types of things from an agricultural perspective. And I know they're talking about primarily land use, but I think land use plays into all of those types of conversations. And we have advisory groups, even the affordable housing group, when we're talking about, you know, farm worker housing and some of those work trends, seasonal workforce housing needs, there's a place for that voice on those committees. My instinct, just having worked in government now for a while, is that when you incorporate those voices in all the different conversations, you actually get further than a standalone conversation where you're just all saying the same thing to each other because you're in alignment. And really the value comes from putting the different voices in rooms where they're trying to solve a problem with all the different interests represented. So that's kind of my feedback on that, is that we just need to be more intentional about finding agricultural voices in those structures we already have.
I tend to be in favor of an agricultural advisory committee and have been from the beginning of being a county commissioner. I remember there was a lot of hoopla about, we had this conversation 4 years ago. Certainly we don't have the money to hire an agricultural ombudsperson position. I don't know that we need a agricultural advisory committee that meets as often as many of our advisory committees meet. But I think that hearing once a year or twice a year from the agricultural community is a reasonable thing for the Board of County Commissioners to have.
How do you, so again, historically, if you separate agriculture from environmental groups, they're going to make recommendations. We'll hear those recommendations. They'll sound good. Then we'll get challenged from the environmental community, who traditionally have been their greatest opposition to land use activities. It just seems like for any board member, the best recommendation comes from groups that are already talking to each other. Right. And so to segregate out just agriculture, where they're talking about their practices, and this makes sense, without understanding, for example, the impact of a cow walking through a stream, of course, a small buffer makes sense to agriculture. They need to farm every inch of their land. But then you've got other groups out there saying, no, we can't have you that close to a stream. This is what the fertilizer means. This is why the cow can't poop in the stream, all the things, right? I don't even know, but that is one that I do historically know. I guess my worry is that when groups make recommendations, they expect action, and without those tensions in those conversations, you set up scenarios for you're not listening to me, right? And so that's, I mean, I get it, but I also have gotten recommendations from the farming community, and a lot of the things they're talking about already exist in our county codes and policies. So it's like, well, you're in your own culture saying things, asking for things that you don't even understand exist. So like, we need more flexibility. Well, that's what a farm plan is. You go to the conservation district, you write a farm plan, you have flexibility. You can get around the codes with the farm plan. That exists today. We have that. That's why we pay the conservation district. So I think that's where some of my worry is coming from, is just the isolation of interest groups, when I think feedback needs to include all of them.
Well, I would agree with that. We have an issue right now with wetlands, and our environmental groups are really concerned right now with about wetlands. And some of it has to do with former wetlands that were then turned into agricultural lands, and nature still trying to make them be wetlands. There is tensions out there. There are those tensions out there. I agree that if people could speak together and come up with a unified voice that addresses everybody's concerns, that'd be fabulous. But I'm not sure that that's a realistic.
We can look into what other counties are doing with their either having an agricultural seat on a committee, or if they have a specific ag committee, mm-hmm. We can bring that back as one of the policies within our land use element.
And then my other thing is, again, are we going to have a builders committee? Are we going to have a septic committee? Are we going to have a pro-Navy committee? Are we going to have an anti-Navy committee? Are we going to have a Nichols Brother industrial use of the waterfront committee? I mean, I'm not trying to be snarky, but it is also like, it is an industry-specific advocacy group that exists also in the form of the Farm Bureau. That you know, I mean, we do have a lot of environmental committees, but WEAN exists as its own separate committee.
Yeah, they're not a county.
Right, they're not a county committee. They're their own committee advocating for a specific point of view. I would never, and this will come to no surprise, advocate for an environmental only committee, right? Mm-hmm. Like, even with the committees we have, I'm like, you need to put the tension in the committees. Right. So again, I think my pushback is a little just interest group specific, not being around the tension. I mean, I could get outvoted. It's fine. I'm not going to die over not having an agriculture committee supportive of agriculture. It's just the precedent of why this particular industry and it should the forestry group have a committee. I mean, it's just as noble as agriculture, right? It's a land use. Should forest practices all get to have a committee that's staffed up? This is my worry. This, I've shared all my worries. I don't have to be right at the table. These are just my worries about why I'm kind of like not sure on that.
Thank you.
Look forward to hearing what they say.
Yeah.
What you find out.
Sounds good. The next recommendation is to review the Island County Code for barriers to agritourism activities. Now, agritourism is when you're already farming on your land and you bring some aspect of tourism, just for anybody who's not.
And did this group look into what we did with rural event centers? Because we had a lot of this conversation in that time period and weighed a lot of those tensions about when you incentivize agritourism to a point that you lose the agricultural activity. That was the underlying fear, right? That all of a sudden the farm becomes kind of a tourism thing, but it's not a producer of agricultural needs. That was the tension that got vetted through the Planning Commission and the public during the Rural Event Center conversation. So I don't want to recreate that conversation when I think it may have already happened.
Okay.
If there's specific things, great, but the conversation itself happened not too long ago. We did a lot of that tension. I understand the agricultural community wasn't thrilled, but there was a reason that there were limitations on agritourism. But I don't know if it means like, you know, food prep of like farm to table meals, if there's things like that that might be in the health code. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just want to make sure we don't have the same conversation again.
I'll have to do more research into that. But the Planning Commission did bring up a good point of what agritourism activities are consistent with our Island County values. So that was something that we'd be considering.
So is that something like, you know, is it my pumpkin patch?
Yes, kind of that's stuff? Considered a, yeah. Or the hay rides, or pet the horses.
Those people should be involved with the JAG, or excuse me, the Tourism Board, and Gracewood being, you know, I wonder if they have a voice on those things, or if they're involved in chambers.
I mean, I think for, I think the hard part for agriculture is that they're working all the time.
Well, that's right? True.
And so they don't participate as much because you get up early and then you go to bed tired.
Yeah.
But I think that's a good point, which is there's all these other avenues for some of these voices to come forward. I think I just don't know. I don't want to revisit the land use necessarily portion of that part of the conversation, but if there's specific activities that we're prohibiting, I think the decision to say you can only have so many events a year and still be considered an agricultural use was where we didn't want the use to change, right? We still want it to be in agricultural production. But what I don't understand on that is, are the activities promoting agriculture and supplementing agriculture instead of replacing agriculture? And if there's barriers to the supplement or mm-hmm. the promotion of that part, I think it's important to know. But just opening the door for it to look like a farm but not be a farm,
right?
That's a door too far. We've talked about that as a community already.
Okay,
that's right.
I just had a couple things. Jonathan Lang, planning director. I think we'll review their comments that have come in. I do think that there's a lot embedded in there with different things, both health codes and planning codes. So we'll look at their input on that, and we'll bring it back at that time for the Island County Code updates.
And then to compromise on my blend them in, a work group that is not a standalone committee, but that is given specific tasks to say, what barriers to agricultural tourism activities currently exist that you would like a work group kind of concept with a specific task that gets disbanded at the end of the work.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that I think could be utilized in lots of different county conversations where it's like you bring in the experts, they do the deep dive, they give you their recommendations, and then.
Mm-hmm. Good idea.
Yeah. I agree.
Next is to include all ag policies from the SEDS report and the economic development element. And like I said, with the Legion's recommendations, we will be including all of the SEDS goals and policies. Next is to coordinate the development of a proactive strategy to address future water availability. There will be a coordinated water system plan update sometime in the next few years. They're currently studying what's needed to do for that update now. So maybe we could include something in that if Chris Kelly is listening to
like
look at agricultural
retention
water.
Ponds on their farms. Just kidding. They don't want that. Takes up too much space.
Next is to identify and address the need for farm worker housing.
I think we're all in on that one. We agree.
The Planning Commission said that. Did some research and brought up a point that the scale of the farms in our county may not be large enough to have specific farm worker housing. Farm worker housing in the state code is extremely strict on who can live in the farm worker housing.
Mm.
So they were saying that we should also promote all housing, and maybe we could include some of the units could be for farm workers, just not to restrict the type of housing that would be built. But we could also continue to promote.
We just want a place for people who are working on our farms to be able to live while they are here in our community.
Those farms should use their coordinated kitchen and build a lot of standalone bedrooms. With bathrooms in them and a microwave and a hot plate, and you're good to go. I don't believe there's limitations on that. So some of this exists. We're just not thinking about how to creatively use our existing code. They don't need their own full-scale kitchen. Without a full-scale kitchen, you have a bedroom. That's all. And your septic.
I have no idea what kitchen you're talking about.
Well, we have a code that says you can have unlimited standalone bedrooms.
It's considered a dwelling unit if there's a kitchen. Commissioner
Bacon. If you don't put a kitchen in it, it's a bedroom. It could have a bathroom. It's an ensuite. It can have a microwave. It could have a hot plate. Mm. It has its own bedroom. That is better than your college dorm. And I lived in that one of those for a while. So we have existing solutions, but this is part of where everyone wants standalone language. But the solution currently exists in our code. You can do that right now, today, if your septic works. That's the part I can't.
I think part of the discussion with the Planning Commission as well was that addressing affordable housing, addressing housing everywhere will help with the farmers and the housing that they need for workers as well. Whereas if you look at the code at what a farm worker housing is, it's very specific, like Emily was saying, for the state code. But if we're addressing housing across the county, it should address and help with this situation as well.
Okay.
And finally, the last recommendation is to support farmers in accessing resources and technical assistance regarding regenerative farming practices.
So that we didn't, because we talked about EDC before before we were here. EDC, that's an EDC thing.
And the conservation district.
And the conservation district, that's right.
Conservation district used to be at this table all the time in partnership with us.
Yeah.
I don't know where they're at.
Yeah.
But that's what they do. We pay them.
Yeah.
And you're right, the EDC.
The EDC should include agriculture, because that is an economic, serious economic industry here in the county.
Okay, any other thoughts on these recommendations before we move forward?
They're good.
Okay. Next is with Island Roots Housing. The first one is to expand shelter options and integrate support services.
Okay, now, how is that a comp plan item? Is it because they want us to plan for size and scale, or how? I'm not trying to be difficult. To understand, like, some of these are behavioral things, or like the one about mental health services. I'm like, that's not a land use item. Like, that's not how you pay for mental health services, is not in the comp plan.
Correct.
This one too, help me understand the connection to the comp.
So with this comprehensive plan cycle, with our allocations and the HAPS rule, we were allocated, I think it was 90 emergency housing units. So those will most likely have to be in shelter or some other form of emergency housing. Now, a shelter doesn't always have to be a building. We could do RV safe parks, and Emily drafted a memo that's actually being presented at the Planning Commission tonight. So people could tune into that, and then we'll be bringing that to the board later in April regarding emergency housing options.
So then, is this kind of encouraging us to think about more on the ground options, but then recognizing we'll need supportive services around those depending upon what? So if we pick a safe space RV park, we would then need to be prepared to say you'll need these types of supportive services. That's correct. What they're saying is the land use is one consideration, but don't forget the other part.
Yes, and to work with our health partners, and also to ensure that these shelters are not placed all the way on the east side in Dugala Bay, where they would be very hard for them to get to the services that they need access to.
Okay.
The second recommendation is to designate locations for temporary and transitional housing, including RV parks and modular housing. The Planning Commission brought up the point that I think we all hear a lot, is that if we are going to be designating RV zones or zones where RV parks are allowed, we just have to consider the health and safety of the people living in the RV. So make sure that there's septic access and that there could be RV inspections to make sure that the RVs are safe to be living in.
What's the status of that bill? Isn't there a let everyone have an RV on their lot bill? Or was that a dream?
No,
there is.
Did it die? It would have died on Wednesday, or it's still alive?
I'll have to check, and then I can either give you, I'll give you an update at our one-on-one on Friday.
Okay, thanks.
And send Commissioner Johnson an email with that.
I'm going to WASAC after this meeting, so they're going to tell me.
Sounds great.
So you just need to tell Melanie, because I'll forget to tell. Sorry.
No worries.
I'm not good on the report back.
I mean, if that goes through, that'll change a lot of things.
Right.
The whole conversation changes then.
Okay. It'll be, yeah. Recommendation is to increase representation of BIPOC and marginalized voices in planning processes. Roots, or the GooseFit Consortium, they hired someone to go out and talk face-to-face with BIPOC people in our community to build those relationships when they were doing their survey.
The other option would be to help us recruit Planning Commission members while they're out there, because that is our voice to diversify housing mm-hmm. and land use policy.
Totally.
It's just, I can just speak for myself, is I'm not well integrated in different groups in the community to always recruit well. So it'd be good if our partners helped in that recruitment as well, and put those, recommended those voices for our existing boards.
That would be great.
I mean, I'm just trying to encourage, I just want to take advantage of their work.
Definitely. And I think all of them are online, so hopefully that they heard that.
Okay, good.
Next is to strengthen policies against discrimination in rental and home ownership opportunities.
So what policies are weak? I mean, I'm happy to strengthen policies if it's necessary. Which ones are weak?
We are still reviewing the housing element. Emily Neff, I know you're online. I don't know if you have any specific policies that need strengthening, but we could promote certain housing.
I don't know that I'm not trying to push back on this because we share the intention. I don't know we that do. We have local control over these policies. So the rental, I mean, these are some state regulated policies or some federal regulated fair housing mm-hmm. laws. I don't know that those rest at our level. We zone, and once the zoning's in place, we have nothing to do with who goes in that zone. I mean, we don't say this person can go here and this person can't. It's probably based on what happened with the
in the past. I think people are so horrified about what happened in the past.
But we don't, even when we do cladding, which we don't really do too much anymore, it's already done. Once we don't control who goes into a facility, those laws are somewhere else. So okay. I'm not sure that that's at our level of government.
Okay, I will make note of that.
If you determine it is, let us know.
We're supportive. I just don't know that it's at our.
And then finally, the final recommendation is to preserve existing naturally affordable housing stock, rural services, and open spaces.
What's naturally affordable housing stock?
Naturally affordable is considered older apartments, which we don't have many apartments in rural Island County. And then it's older single family homes and manufactured home communities.
Okay.
And then a few thoughts from the Planning Commission. They are interested.
Oh, I do have a thought on that.
Okay.
So part of where we're having problems with preservation of naturally affordable housing stock is non-conforming use.
Yes.
So if there's code language that we could put in there that says a non-conforming use, that you can make improvements to non-conforming use, provided that it delivers this underlying housing type. That's the problem we're having on North Whidbey with the mobile home park, is that by the time they make the improvement, they're out of compliance with that zone and they can't get permits. Mm-hmm. So something around that, I think that could help there. That makes sense to me.
Okay. So the Planning Commission also, part of it for existing naturally affordable housing stock was to look at regulating short-term rentals, as some older homes could be rented out as short-term rentals now, but if we looked into how we could regulate short-term rentals, maybe some more affordable long-term rentals could be on the market.
Right.
And more about that in that housing memo that will be coming in April.
Mm-hmm.
The Planning Commission also was curious and asked planning how we would identify areas to support temporary housing. And temporary housing or permanent supportive housing is best located near services, transit, and infrastructure. So close to a sewer or a large on-site or off-site septic. So those are just things that we'll be considering as we are looking how we will meet our housing numbers.
I mean, I also think it's really important in these conversations about located next to that our employment centers, Oak Harbor's the easiest solution for this in terms of, it's not the easiest in terms of access to employment.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are working as a, you know, if the service industry in Langley during the tourism season, you're not going to catch a transit bus at the end of the night and ride all the way back up to your location in Oak Harbor. That's not going to happen. So we need to continue those flexibility conversations around the Clinton Raids, Lamrids, Freeland Raid, Lamrid, and then if there's not community flexibility around that, if we can't get this housing type in there, there needs to be a very clear understanding that it's Langley. that the housing will have to go in Langley, which means that I cannot hear conversations about, well, we're a village. You're not, you're a city. You pick the city title. But just to be clear that if the vision is in people's minds, well, we'll put people up in Oak Harbor where there's services, and those services need to be put in on South Whidbey. Transit access needs to exist on South Whidbey, and this housing type has to go on South Whidbey. There's a regional distancing that's happening. It's literally like saying, well, workforce housing can be in Oak Harbor if you work on Kameno. That's not true. So I just want to make sure that there's not a vision in the mind of the Planning Commission that this is a consolidation of that housing on the north end of the island. That will not work for the types of problems that they're trying to solve.
I think the Planning Commission recognizes that the south end is in desperate need of more affordable housing. And our Clinton sub-area plan, the comment period closes Friday at 4:30. So we encourage anybody to submit comments. And we'll bring that draft back with our final drafts of the comprehensive plan.
We need help, community help, support,
totally,
justification for why we need to densify some of these other areas as well.
Exactly. And the GMA does promote densifying where density already exists, which is our LAMRDs and our UGAs.
You mentioned Clinton sub-area plan. Are we getting comments?
We are getting comments. We have about 40 comments on our website, and then maybe 10 or so more in our email.
Okay.
So far, we're getting good feedback. Yeah.
Good.
Okay.
These are all good.
Thank you. Next is from Whidbey Environmental Action Network. The first recommendation was to expand, protect, and restore riparian buffers. Interrupt me, I'm going to keep going, but one after that is to improve wastewater treatment practices and enforcement, enforce mitigation requirements, and increase mitigation compliance standards, prohibit lifting development moratoria on some logged land. And with that one, the Planning Commission was interested in writing a new definition in PBRS for stewardship, specifically for forests, as they believe that if there were better stewardship practices, maybe some people wouldn't log their land to the degree that the DF program requires.
We do have PBRS forestry practices on the work plan for this year to look at that issue within that program area. Right. So we're not incentivizing.
Correct.
Different type. Just want to make sure we weren't losing that conversation.
We are not. The next is to incentivize restoration of contiguous and interconnected habitat.
Can we talk about what that means to incentivize that? I mean, we all love contiguous habitat. They want the county to incentivize it.
I mean, like, I think.
Sure. Don't talk about frogs, please.
I'm not going to say frogs. I actually have a vision for this.
Okay.
So I think that targeting our conservation futures purchases and partnering with our land trusts better on purchases that allows us to identify the corridor, and that is an incentive, right? Mm-hmm. So it doesn't always have to be a tax incentive, but that we need to incentivize those purchasing relationships to say, okay, if we're going to preserve, let's be more strategic about how we're preserving so that we end up with something bigger than hodgepodge parcels all over the place. That it needs to go towards a coordinated plan, and that, you know, and the incentive would be, if you're the last parcel we need for the plan, well, ka-ching to you, I guess.
Yes.
But that's an idea.
Great. Yeah.
There's
like
no
it.
Toads.
I like it.
I think part of that was in things like our planned residential developments or our PBS program, if there's incentives or ways that they could get more points for being interconnected with a nearby system. I think that's what they're also speaking to.
Oh, yeah, that's fair.
Okay.
The Planning Commission also, along with this recommendation, asked if there was a way to incentivize critical areas, habitat, forest, and shoreline to further protect them. And I think the PBRS program is one great way that people could be incentivized to protect their land.
Mm-hmm. So I want to point out one thing. This is almost totally shit.
Okay.
This slide does nothing for affordability, nothing. In fact, it works against affordability unless there is an allowance to densify more appropriate areas. So if we can't add more density to areas that are less valuable to preserve, this, all of these recommendations create scarcity, right? And they're not bad recommendations. They're not based in bad values, but they are protections. Protections mean no development. No development means fewer houses. Fewer houses mean higher prices. And that is where I don't feel that this whole consortium yet has consorted, because one recommendation was get more affordability, and this does not lend itself to that. In fact, some of these things, protecting and restoring riparian buffers, is counter to what agriculture is about to say. We need more incentives in agricultural practices. And so although this is helpful, what's also helpful is when the community understands that these are directly opposing actions, that to do this, we don't achieve the Island Roots goals, mm-hmm. unless we have flexibility on where we put that growth. We have to develop in rural areas even less than one house per 5 acres, or we can't achieve these types of things. There has to be give and take on that.
I appreciate that. That's an acknowledgement of the tensions we were talking about earlier. And I guess what I would just say is that we want X and we want Y, and we just have to figure out how to deal with the tensions between achieving both of those goals.
Right. These are good goals, but then we have to be flexible somewhere else. We can't challenge the one house per 5 acres. We have to say to the state, look, this isn't going to work for us. We need to put density here. We need to allow it.
And
this is what we can achieve if we're able to do that.
A good call out would be a transfer development program, which I was looking at. John just
yeah.
wrote it down, but I was looking into it earlier this week, and that's when you would be protecting one area and providing higher density in a different area. Mm-hmm. Our last comprehensive plan did call for Island County to create that program.
It needs it.
We did not create it.
And lastly, which is a recommendation we've heard not just from Ween, but from a lot of people, is to advocate to the state for island-specific mm-hmm. considerations. As you both know, comprehensive planning is directed, a lot of the recommendations are directed towards the much more dense municipalities and counties, and smaller counties like ours struggle sometimes. So they wanted to highlight that fact. That was certain things, such mm-hmm. as a large population increase, it might be hard.
Is San Juan County a GMA county?
They are.
So they would be a good natural partner, because they also have entire islands that do not have urban areas, right? And so I think that's one of the unique things that we have in common with them is, you know, Kameno, we need solutions for Kameno, but it's treated the same as every rural area we have, when in fact it's its own standalone entity and needs variety of housing choices and options, and we just don't have them over there. And I'm guessing San Juan would be a good partner, because they're probably dealing with the same drama.
Emily and I met with their planners a few months ago. It was a very enlightening conversation. We are all struggling with the same issues with this comprehensive plan update. Any more thoughts on Ween's recommendations?
They look good.
Okay. That was all from us today.
They're all very thoughtful.
Yeah.
They were. Their presentations were great. Mm-hmm. If I know you both are very busy, but if you ever have time to look through them, if you have any more thoughts, many more recommendations. Those were all I could fit on the slides to make this brief, but planning will be looking through all of them and seeing mm-hmm. how we can tie them into our comprehensive plan as they fit. And you will see that in the draft elements.
Well, I really appreciate the American Legion of Kameno, ARCIC, Island Roots Housing, and Ween for all of the work and the outreach they did to community to come up with these recommendations. A lot of great work by our community members. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
That was good.
All right, where are we? We're not going to talk with the assessor today, but we are going to have the conversation with the auditor's office. So the auditor's office can come up, please.
What? I won't have as much to say on the rest of these topics.
Oh, okay.
Morning, commissioners.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Emily Dalfredi, Chief Deputy Auditor. This is Michelle Reagan, our election supervisor. And we're bringing forward some quotes for a elections ballot sorter slash scanner. And I am going to leave it to Michelle to explain what exactly that is and how it helps the office.
What this sorter scanner does is you would place the ballots, the unopened ballot envelopes, into the conveyor, into the hopper, and it pulls those envelopes one by one through a high-speed scanner, which then takes an image of the signature area on that ballot envelope, and then it puts that into a tub and then creates a report for each of those tubs, so it tracks where each of those ballots has gone into which tub. Then instead of pulling each individual tray of ballots onto an individual worker's desk at the workstation and holding them up one at a time to scan them in with a wand scanner to enter them into the system or to verify the signature on that envelope side by side with the image on the screen from the voter registration. By pulling that file into the election system, the scanned image from the envelope that the scanner has taken is automatically compared to the voter registration record and the signature that's in the record there. That accomplishes a great many things. It eliminates several of the steps that are done manually at current, which can take a long time. It is a very labor-intensive process.
It's those 20,000 ballots per hour.
Yes, it's rated for up to 20,000 ballots per hour that it can run through that scanner. So now what takes us several hours to do by half a dozen people or more will now considerably lessen the amount of time that it takes to get done and would reduce the number of people needed to perform these tasks. So it would no longer create, in essence, a bottleneck in that part of the process. And that would enable those ballots to be verified and then moved on to the extractions process and the counting process that much quicker.
How would this change the reliability of our verification?
Absolutely not at all. What it does is it takes the image of that ballot, and so the signature that the voter puts on that ballot is photographed right there, and then it pulls up, you know, that barcode that's on your envelope that's not connected to the ballot inside. Mm-hmm. What it does is it tells the system who that voter is and what election this is for. So what that does is it compares the signature image on the ballot and it pulls up that voter's record. Once we upload that information, it pulls up that voter's record in the voter registration. So you're still comparing the signature on the envelope to the signature in the voter record. You're just doing it on screen at a much faster pace than you are doing it one by one by physically moving those ballots.
So it's still because you a couple of times the way you've spoken of this, Michelle, it sounded like the machine was comparing the signatures. It still remains the humans comparing the signatures. It's just that it appears to them in an easier fashion.
Yes. What it does now, you have this tray of ballots, you're pulling up one ballot, you're holding it up to the image on the screen for the voter record. What this does when it takes those images is it imports those onto that same screen that the voter record is on. So what we would then see as processors is at the top, we would see the four, because it does it four at a time. You would see the four voter record signatures for four different voters. And then underneath it, you would see the scanned images from the ballot envelopes that we've just put through for those same four voters. So you're still comparing it. You're just doing it on screen as opposed to in paper. And you can do it much faster because you're not having to shuffle all of these envelopes, frankly, all over the place.
You also mentioned number of people, does this mean that we wouldn't need as many people working in the elections office? Or?
What it does mean, because rather than looking at the number of people, what we're looking at and what we bill for is the number of work hours.
Mm-hmm.
So what it means is that those temporary election workers that are currently utilized for signature verification in the front office or checking those ballots in at the front might now be better utilized if we put them in the vault working on scanning, or putting them in the workroom where they can help with the extraction to get that through faster. So it wouldn't necessarily mean a different number of people, but we do expect that it will mean fewer hours.
And we also do pull accounting and recording and licensing staff if needed up to elections to help
you,
with that
we do
process.
Okay, and those people are paid certainly much more than the
yes.
minimum wage
yes.
that election
and this would pay. Minimize the need to do that, yes.
And that definitely is a bottleneck area, you know, nothing else could happen until that process is done.
Commissioner Johnson?
So it's not the tool that I'm going to have questions about. Do you know how much power this takes, and will it fit on our existing electrical without rewiring anything or blowing a circuit breaker?
So Ryan Beach was nice enough to contact me this morning when he saw that this was on there.
Because I talked to Ryan about the power.
Where'd that page go? So I let him know what kind of plug that will need, and he doesn't think it'll be a big deal. He still needed to talk to John, but I think we'll be okay over there. It just needs possibly a different plug itself. I don't think we'll have to pull in extra electricity or anything.
If we went any farther with this, we would want that really clear.
I mean, I'm not going to say yes mm-hmm. until I know the infrastructure cost to the building.
Mm-hmm.
It because these electrical panels, I mean, we've got one in this building we're talking about right now that we just learned is we've got so much on it, it could go, and it's $1 million-ish to replace it. And so, I mean, this is, and the way we've got that lease written in that building, we'd pay. And then I also want to make sure that the generator can support it. So if the power goes out, the generator has to be large enough to support the machine as well. So we've got to make sure it fits with the infrastructure. My next concern is it's not on the capital improvement plan. This is a $200,000 expenditure that did not get budgeted for. And I understand that there's budget capacity that the auditors identified, but major equipment purchases have to go in the capital improvement plan. And it didn't come up in the budget, and it didn't compete with all the other things. So had we known this was coming, we could have asked these types of questions because right now, what I don't know is if it does require an electrical upgrade, if we've got capacity in our plan to do the electrical upgrade because we didn't plan for this and we didn't budget for it. So all of those sequencing things didn't happen. And then my third concern, and this is just a lack of knowledge, I don't think concern's right, is what other things can that fund be used for? Is it only for equipment? Is it for, what can you use these funds for that right now might be a lot of election stuff gets subsidized by current expense. And so I want to make sure that we're not just using this fund to buy something when in fact there were other things the fund could have been used for. And I don't know the answer to that. Maybe it's specific for equipment and it can't be used for
a down payment on a new elections building.
Or right. Or it can't be used for getting the power electrical first, or that's kind of what I don't know is in the ranking of all of the needs that we have in elections, which are significant. Is this piece of equipment the highest priority? I get where it makes it easier, but is a new building a better priority? Can this funding be used? Can it be used for electrical? Can it be used to mail out ballots? Can it be used for, I don't know what the funds can be used for.
Yeah, so it's two different fundings. One is about $140,000 that we've had since 2020. My understanding that one's a little more flexible with what it can be used for. And then we have a second pot of about $70,000 that is specific for security. And Sheila did check to make sure that this would fall under that. And so I know that Sheila and Michelle, I believe, have discussed different things that it could be used for.
I don't know that the HAVA grant, which is the balance of what we're talking about on the grant funding, I don't know that it does or doesn't have a specific line item usage availability. I know that it has to be used for elections, and it cannot be, as I understand it, it cannot be used to supplant a budget item. It has to be used for replacing or upgrading equipment, software, that kind of thing. I don't know what other available uses there might be for it, because it's my understanding that those are the types of uses that we've used it for, because we knew that those were allowed. That's a conversation best had with somebody other than me, because I don't have that information. I'm really good on process, but I don't have that piece of the puzzle for you.
And then, do you know the lifespan of this piece of equipment? So the other part is we buy it, and then we get used to it, and then it breaks. Is this money available again to replace it, or we're taking on the replacement liability for the county, and then out of what funding source for the future? I don't know how. I mean, if it lasts for 50 years, shoot. If it lasts for 5, it's not really my problem. But I just kind of want to have an idea of how. Do we have enough time to save up to replace this type of equipment, or?
I believe Sheila told me 10 years.
So in 10 years, we'd need another 200, let's inflate it. Now we'd need $250,000 to replace it.
Yeah, we can hope for more.
Come on up, Susan.
Elections funding.
I'm not trying to be, I mean, again, I believe in what you're trying to do.
Yes,
it's just that's not what my role is to make it easy to count the
and
ballots.
One concern we do have is that, you know, our election workers are aging, and we do have a hard time recruiting for, you know, seasonal minimum wage position. And so being able to have this big process completed by a machine is very beneficial in that sense as well. The security grant funding does expire in May 2025, so we are in a bit of a time crunch to be able to allocate that to something.
Okay.
I'm told that the HAVA grant, we got an extension, and that pushed it back to 2027. It was supposed to end last year, I believe.
As far as the equipment replacement piece of it, the equipment can be billed out as part of the election expense that could be earmarked for future replacement in that fund. So we could keep track of that over the 10 years and
set aside.
Yep.
I mean, if we can do the set aside, we need commitment from the auditor, and there'll be another one in the future. So we need to, if we purchase this, I'd like some type of resolution that acknowledges that there'll be a set aside to replace the equipment, because the $250,000 is not going to come out of nowhere at this county when that happens, you know?
Yeah, I'm happy to write up whatever reason you did.
This is a kind of a side issue, and I apologize, but I'm glad that you're here and you're here for this. So these are two grants that the auditor has received. Are these included in our budget anywhere?
They're not.
They are not. And I heard yesterday about another elected official who had another grant and went and bought another thing that
a donation.
They received a
donation.
I mean, I'm so in favor of people going out and searching for extra dollars. My only issue is that the people can go out and do that, and then they come to the county for it. It just kind of is interesting, because then we're expected to prioritize where funds are going when they have access to other funds from other places, and we don't even ever hear about it. That's a problem for me. Do we have any kind of sense of how many other, you know, floating dollars we have out there in the county and elected offices that this office never knows anything about, that they're spending on other things? And then they come to us for things that maybe they could have spent some of those floating dollars for. That's
it's a really great roundtable conversation to have. Often we don't find out about the grants until the spending needs to occur.
Most departments are really good about budgeting for the grant funds that they are aware of because they want to spend the money.
Right.
And they want it to be spent easily by having it incorporated into their budget. But I think there is some opportunities for improvement with some of the other departments. And often it gets lost. This other department forgot that they needed to appropriate the money, even though they received it as a donation.
I mean, I think, and again, not to be inflammatory, but this, maybe we need to invite, it's elected officials that do it. It's independently elected. It's not the department heads that report to the board because they know they have no control over their budget. So maybe we need to bring the independent electeds here because certainly, you know, this isn't for you to get in trouble over. But here's the problem. And this is, and I wasn't at the meeting, the roundtable meeting that you had. But I did hear that there was an offer from people who to say, oh, well, we want to be more a part of budget cuts and decisions and how they happen. And of course, I had a visceral reaction to that. And it's based in my own history and experience. And it's also based in history and experience with our department heads that direct report to the board. I know what happens because I've seen it happen. We say, give us the things that you need to cut. And this will loop back around to it. Mm-hmm. Give us the things that you think can be cut. And here's what will happen. I'll pick a department that reports to us, for example. So let's take health. Health will cover all of the programs that they know the board may be willing to cut. They'll cover those. And then they put forward to us, welcome new baby, and say, well, you can cut that. You can make the political choice to cut that, or you can backfill it with current expense. Oh, we'll buy this software we'll fund this software that's extra. And then we'll say, well, we'll have to get rid of our, you know, water quality monitoring software, or we won't be able to keep our hydrologist, or we won't be able to, something that's a known high community value. Basically forcing the board's hand exactly. to cover the thing that the community cares most about or is the greatest need. So what happens in this situation is we just did a budget adjustment where we took money and had to cover some costs in the auditor's office
we addressed that through the budget process.
Right. So what happens is when you, I'll pick on the sheriff because that's another one that we've got right now. You chose to buy a piece of equipment with that, but you came to us and said, well, I need these tasers for the jail. Can we do a budget adjustment to get these tasers from the jail? Can we get this capacity, but use this budget capacity from here to here? Meanwhile, you had an option to buy those, but you chose to buy something else. You chose to buy the thing that we weren't going to value and then forced the county entity, not the commissioners. This isn't about us. It's forced the entity to cover the essential expenses while you, instead of making sure the essential expenses were covered and giving the entity the option to do the extra, you're choosing to buy the frosting and then say, well, commissioners, we don't have a cake to put it on. You have to make the cake. Your money that you get should help the entire entity, not just serve you. So if you get this money, there should be an offset of current expense potentially. But in this scenario, it's not necessarily an outlay, but it could have been an offset. So we could have saved maybe some money that we could have put towards other things that this community values and needs. But we can't do that because we weren't given that choice. It didn't come through the budget process. But it is our responsibility, our elected lane, not to run elections, but to ensure the expenditures happen appropriately and that we're leveraging taxpayer dollars, whatever their source, whether it be a grant or current expense or sales tax or property tax, wherever we get it from. Our responsibility is to leverage those tax dollars appropriately to get the greatest outcome. And when we are denied that opportunity, we can't achieve our job roles and responsibilities. That's got to stop. I mean, we've got three conversations in the last week where we have independently elected officials, or selected officials, I don't know how to say independent. They're elected officials who have gone outside the budget process. Had we not caught these expenditures, we would have no idea. There's liability associated with these things. There's replacement associated with these things. There's infrastructure associated with these things. There's space planning associated with these things. If we buy a piece of equipment and have to buy a bigger building because it doesn't fit, right? I already have community volunteers saying they don't like the space that we're in, and so we're already talking about that. Then we put in a bigger piece of equipment. How am I going to explain that? Those conversations come back to us.
Yep. Thank you for taking the concern I had and articulating it so well, Commissioner, because that's exactly where I was concerned. Thank you.
It's not a control thing. It's a understanding the needs of the institution thing. And no other elected official is seeing the full budget the way that the commissioners do, because we're tasked with budget, right? We're tasked with it. Nobody else is. So I get that. That's not where my critique happens. My critique happens is the lack of recognition of why authorities lay where they lay. Because the expectation is that we do sit through hours of budget meetings and that other electeds don't.
So maybe what we could do this year when we do the budget, maybe we have a special time that we have all the electeds come and we ask them, what other grants are you going to have this year?
It might be appropriate during the discussion on supplementals, which we may not open supplementals, but it opens the conversation about what is it that we're asking for. It's straight faced to each other. So that conversation there, what grant funding do you have available to you is a perfect spot for that too.
So I'm not necessarily opposed to this.
No.
I just want to make sure that the infrastructure we have supports it before we agree to buy it. And I would like something that says that there'll be a replacement set aside in the equipment. I mean, it probably should be a transfer into a fund that is who would buy the software again, IT or I don't know. It needs to get transferred into that fund on a regular basis. And that needs to not go away because there needs to be an understanding. If you get grants, great. But if not, we are going to have to replace this. And so this is a $250,000-ish obligation for the county.
It can be shown as a set aside in the election reserve fund.
So that's $25,000 a year if it's a 10-year lifespan, if I did that math right. Is that right?
With inflation.
Okay, so $25,000-ish a year that has to come from that fund. That fund has to be able to support that, or we don't have a replacement plan in place.
Correct.
Okay. So I'm a tentative yes, provided we could get the structure and we get the assurances we need that the building can support the equipment.
So if we can answer those questions, do I have, you're okay to move forward with a budget amendment that it would allow this purchase to occur?
It's okay with me.
Yeah.
And I'll touch base with you before.
But if the electrical panel or any of that needs to get replaced, that goes first. It's got to go first. I can't put good equipment on a bad system.
Well, it's possible that the grant might cover that if it's needed to get the equipment in place.
So there are two quotes, one with an optional envelope opener, which adds about $20,000 to the cost.
You're going the wrong way.
So one of them would leave $19,000 left of our grant funding. If we did not have that envelope opener, it also adds at least 4 feet to the length of this equipment.
Do you currently have an envelope opener?
We do.
We do.
So we don't.
Yes.
So we don't need an envelope opener if we have a working one,
okay.
I think.
Yeah, it just makes it all go through one process.
We currently have the envelope opener in the same room where the ballots are extracted from the envelopes. The crew waits until the signatures are verified. They manually feed those in through the envelope opener, and then they extract the ballots. So, and it is currently working. So we do currently have one, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I of all people want ballots counted quickly. I think we can agree.
Yeah.
But I also just... I made a few decisions where I thought, oh, we'll get this server or we'll get this software or we'll put our phones on this system. And then the next thing you learn is your system doesn't support the technology that you put it on. So I've just learned the hard way that the system, the infrastructure has to work before You can get the thing you put on it. And our infrastructure is old, and it was built for a different time, and it's getting maxed out with all the things we're putting on the power systems. And so once we check that out and we have enough money to replace it, then I'm done with my draw.
So this $213,500, I'm assuming that you have here, I'm assuming that's what the machine's going to cost, $213,500, or is it that you have grants of $213,500, which is it?
So I do have on this sheet a comparison of the quotes. We got two quotes. One is way over, I think it adds like over $100,000. So run back, yeah. So we don't want to go with that one. The Tri-Tech one, the total initial cost with sales tax without the envelope opener is $194,207. I split out the software maintenance is billable. So I split that out from that to show what those a 5-year cost would be, but those are completely billable to elections. And then I also have with the envelope opener, total with sales tax is $214,226. And so the envelope opener, we're slightly underfunded by about $700. Without the envelope opener, we have $19,305.
Okay, so you have $19,000 left from the HAVA grant, I assume.
Both grants.
Both grants.
Yeah.
Included.
Yeah. So HAVA, we've got $142,000 almost left over that one. We already have the cash from that one since 2020.
Mm-hmm.
The security grant, which expires in May of 2025. We have got $71,600 left over of that. That one's reimbursement based.
We got to do that fast.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Sorry you had to be the messenger.
I appreciate it.
All righty. Public Works. Thank you for coming over early.
Oh, not a problem. Brett Snarley, Public Works Director. I have with me Matthew Lander, the Assistant County Engineer, who's going to speak to the two topics we have in front of you this morning.
The first item is a revision of CDP for Utzalotti Road, Olson Culvert Replacement Fish Passage Project.
Mm-hmm.
This project was a zero slope culvert and a ditch stream. And so originally it was going to be designed with as little area of disturbance as possible. However, during the permit process, we've been required to regrade and do upstream fish stream improvements.
Is Gertie's Road below this? Am I in the right spot?
So it goes to, if the water that this goes to the South Gertie's outfall, which is not the private outfall of concern. So this helps more water go through a county outfall instead of a private one.
Perfect. Okay. I'm in support of this one then. I just wanted to make sure that we were considering how much water got dumped down in that area because we already have some community sensitivities, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We met them.
Yeah.
So are you saying, I want to make sure I'm understanding that this is $275,000 more than we had anticipated was going to be?
Correct. This was going to be essentially a pipe under the road, a single slope. That was the vision of the engineer in 2022. Unfortunately, stakeholders and the regulators saw it differently.
Because they identify every ditch now as a fish passage. And so we have to do fish passage on things that have been traditional drainage ditches. This is happening everywhere. It's why those maps are so concerning to, I'm not, this is pontification, but it's why those maps have been so concerning to people where we put in farm ditches or we've put in drainage ditches, we put in man-made ditches, and then the state has identified those as fish streams. Now we have all these costs that are escalating what used to be drainage systems into fish passage. This was the effect of not fighting back on those designations. That's what has now happened. I mean, you said fish ditch, right? It's because we know it to be a drainage ditch. That's how the system worked. And then it got redesignated and we didn't fight those designations. And now here we are with fish passage culverts where we originally had normal culverts. It's the same thing that's happening at the Swantown drainage area, which is, we know we don't need it. We don't, it's brackish water. We don't need a fish passage there, but we're going to do the fish passage there. It drives up the cost. It is what it is.
Okay.
That's what happened.
So where is this extra $275,000 coming from?
It'll come from the road fund. And this also, because we moved this project forward in construction, and we had some turnover with our project engineer,
mm-hmm.
We didn't account for it in our TIP.
Mm-hmm.
So while we don't believe this will affect our overall dollar amount for 2025 due to some other projects.
Moving around other things.
Either, you know, we internally see that, and so we won't affect our overall number, but the alternative would be we could move construction back to 2026 if we had concern about our total 25 road one.
Well, I'm not going to try even remotely try to micromanage where you decide when you're going to do different projects. I just, you know, $275,000 we hadn't planned on spending. So, okay.
I mean, the reality is that your amount that you're spending this year isn't changing. You're just going to have to push something else back.
Okay.
That's what's going to happen. How did this project get moved up, though? I'm kind of curious about that.
Because we had anticipated the long amount of permitting because of
a fish,
and then we were able to get it sooner than expected.
Okay. So it moved up because permits move faster.
Which is a good thing. It's
I'm not complaining about that. I mean, I think the cost escalation is problematic. And I think what we want to better have an update at some point is maybe like at the 6-month review of what's getting done this year and what's getting pushed back. Just so we're better able to see, you know, kind of where, how these projects are flexing around. I mean, I just want to be really clear. We're not adding this amount of money to the road fund for 2025. What I think I'm saying is, yes, you're doing this project and you're going to switch projects around to live within your means.
Yep. And a couple of those projects are out of our ability to do this year.
Yeah.
And so,
like Swantown drainage. It's a pipe dream. I've accepted the reality.
I'm for you getting your.
I know. I'm just telling you, it's one of those things that they call fantasies. So, but I'm going to hold fast to it.
Okay, good.
But I guess.
Is there any economic value to it? We could do rural county economic development funds for it.
It's a road that connects an entire, it goes under a major road that connects housing areas to the Navy base. That's as close as I can get. That's pretty good, though. Right off the top of my head, that's pretty good.
We're gonna need you guys to apply for some rural county economic development funds this year. That's where that came from. Okay, yeah, consent.
Thank you
so much.
The second item is our annual reports to the County Road Administration Board, and three of the items. Either need a signature from the chair and then one from the board. The three that need board approval are the road levy, including the diversion to the sheriff department, fish passage barrier removal projects outside of the right-of-way, and our policy updates, which includes a change in our org chart.
And how did your org chart change?
Two right-of-way staffs moved from the assistant public works director to the county engineer.
When do you have to have this done by?
The end of this month.
So next Tuesday is the last chance you have to get it done.
Where did the positions move? Sorry.
It moved from the assistant public works director to under the county engineer.
So it's basically the same, it's just a title change.
Basically, who they report to is the only change.
They report to James, now they report to head.
Yeah. Correct.
And who was it that moved again? I'm sorry.
It was
Ann and Mary are right-of-way specialists.
The right-of-way specialists. I guess right-of-way goes under the
The Make engineer. More sense to have it under roads because that's where the right-of-ways are. So,
But does it need an engineer supervising?
It was an engineer before. James is an engineer also.
James is an engineer also?
He is.
And final right-of-way documents are signed by the county engineer. So, like, even if the county engineer wasn't the supervisor, the documents would still have to go through the county engineer.
Does it give you enough checks and balances that way if the supervisor is the signer?
Through that system, we believe it does.
Okay.
So
it's a transfer of funds to the sheriff's office also for based on eligible expenses.
And yeah, and that, and the numbers are come up from our budget director. So
yeah, no, I know that part's it. The right. I just want the language as a transfer. So we're not diverting funds. We're transferring eligible funds. It's a thought process difference just because those are services that are provided on the roads for road safety. Yep. That's what makes them eligible. Okay.
Is there a document that needs to be changed?
No, I just wanted just said, to clarify.
You're talking about the language. It was used in the conversation.
Because I'm sensitive about it. Because some people think it's a taking. It's really not. It's in conjunction with safe roads. So I just want the language clear.
Sounds good.
And then,
okay.
For Fish Passage, we spent $0 outside of county right away on Fish Passage project. So that's just a signature.
Well, that's easy.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're sending these to consent.
Okay.
They electronically get sent to the chair, and then I believe the org chart will go to consent.
But we have to authorize the chair at a meeting.
Okay.
So all the documents go to consent, and then how they get signed doesn't matter. The board has to give the chair consent.
Okay.
We don't give her individual power, mostly because I was the chair once. And so they limited the heck out of that. So that still meets your timeline to get it on the consent.
If we get on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Tuesday.
We'll give the head nod and then Melanie can sign as the chair and all the things.
Okay. Perfect.
Okay. We're good.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Commissioner, we got through our entire day's worth of work session items. Did you have anything else?
I had one quick little add-on that may or may not be quick.
Okay.
We might want Janet. But so we have our requests into the state, and my understanding is that the ITUA beds are on our representatives and senators' list to get funding for the 6 additional beds.
True. Okay.
The conversation we had yesterday at Board of Health and some conversations that I've been asking more questions about are talking about a lack of state dollars going into our regional system that would pay for non-Medicaid in all of these facilities. Yesterday they mentioned 52 new beds are coming on in our region. There is not enough non-Medicaid money to pay for all of those beds in the proportion that we're paying with Medicaid, non-Medicaid, and they need to serve all the providers need to serve non-Medicaid patients in order to make budget. If we're already at a shortfall with the beds that are coming on, I'm wondering about saying to our representatives, this isn't the year to ask for that money because there's not money in the system to stabilize those providers for those additional beds.
So you're saying that we would hold on that?
I'm wondering if we should just say, let's pull our ask out. We still need it, but we need it when this funding is stabilized to support the beds, because I'm worried if we get the money and then we're obligated to build it, that we're going to actually work against our interests rather than for our interests. We did it because we want more funding to the provider.
Sure.
But if we don't have the right kind of funding going into the system, and if they cut Medicaid, we're going to be asking for state dollars in a very competitive year to do something that we're not going to be able to operate. And I didn't, I don't feel comfortable making that. That's not my call to make as an individual. It's mm-hmm. more of the board saying, hey, we need to pivot. If you can get us something else, or we acknowledge the budget year you're in, we can hold until we figure these other funding things out.
Okay. Well, you know, Commissioner, I you have been pushing for these beds because we need the beds, but I totally trust when you pull back and say, well, this is not the year for us to be asking for that. I trust your judgment on that. So I'm going to support you on that. So do we need to ask, can we just authorize you to connect with?
I'll talk to Josh. And then I'll talk to our folks. I mean, I just don't want them to use political capital if we're not going to get
exactly
do what we need to do. I don't want to hurt their reputation. No. I don't want to hurt ours. And I don't want to set the provider up to fail.
Right. Right.
Like all, we got a perfect storm of problems right now.
Okay. No, I support that.
Okay. And I'll check with one other funding person to make sure. I mean, I've talked with Jan Rose from the ASO mm-hmm. to say, you know, do you think this is the right year? And she's not going to tell us no, but it's our priority, but she's basically said we don't have enough funding for the beds that are coming online if the state doesn't change their funding allocation. And if they do, we can go back and say, now we need it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. I'll do some legwork.
Anything else?
That's it.
All righty. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you, everybody.
I don't know.